30 PM, so call me in order, please, part of the pledge of allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Since this is the first meeting of the year, we have some business to take care of before we start the regular agenda. And first item on the agenda is to elect the chairman. And I'll accept motions from the board to nominate chairman for 2013.
I make motion to nominate Sean Kenny, chairman, for 2013.
Very well. Any other motion? Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Nay? Anyone opposed, say nay. Motion carries 5-0.
Why don't you bring this back over to the board?
Mr. Nichols? Do you want to elect a vice chairman, is there any motion?
I nominate Tony Brock as chair.
Mrs. Maynes, is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mrs. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Moving on to the resolution entitled organizational meeting of Lander County Board of Supervisors 2013.
Now, the meeting resolution is kind of following. Nothing really changed on there, except that it's just the reissuance of the same exact standard that we used this year for the location meetings here at the courts building, and then day meetings and night meetings at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. on the first and third Wednesdays of the month. Now, what is added on here is the work sessions. We've added a work session following the day meeting of each month, except in the month of August. But the work sessions, you all have a choice to make on whether you want to make that 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. We had put down 6 o'clock through the packages here. We know we have enough time to get done even if it's covered in between if need to. And then a 6 o'clock work session has been planned for today. But if 6 o'clock is the minimum, if you're minimum at 6 o'clock, then this is the motion that we cover location, day, and time for the meeting.
Yeah, I think 6 o'clock is good. Time to try to get out and do anything, get back, and have a bite to eat. That's when you stay with 6.
Now, those are as needed.
Well, they're scheduled, they will be scheduled every month. They're on the calendar, you'll see. If we don't have something to put on that work session, then we will just not hold the work session. We'll announce that the month before. But for instance, the December one we have in the school, January, this one we've got with Treasury Commissioner Rowden, and the first one in February, on February 6th, we have scheduled the IT from both county government and from schools, right, information technology staff coming from the government. After that, if there's a new board, we'll have a special presentation or special session. If not, especially through the budget season, we can have a lot of extra meetings, may not need to. But they're just scheduled as placeholders throughout the entire year.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the resolution entitled organizational meeting of Lander County Board of Supervisors 2013, designates the location, day, and time of the meetings, meeting place, circuit court of the Lander County Board of Supervisors. Meeting times, day, meeting, 2 p.m., and end at 6 p.m. or less extent. Work sessions begin at 6 p.m. and end at 9 p.m. Night meetings begin at 7 p.m. and end at 11 p.m. or less extent.
Motion is made by Mr. Chester, seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0.
And then on the selection of dates for the board meetings, standard dates selected again, but as you'll see on here, it shows the regular meetings on the first Wednesday, 1 to 2 p.m., second meeting on the third Wednesday, 7 p.m., and then the work sessions on the following, those first meetings at 6 p.m. The only two differences come in August, where we have a combined meeting, a 2 o'clock and 7 o'clock meeting on the first Wednesday of August. And then in the month of November, there's an actual Tuesday meeting in lieu of Wednesday. And now that I think about it, I'm not positive that's required for this year, because I think Thanksgiving is on November 28th is coming here. Is that fair enough? Can you check and see? So if you'd like to entertain this motion, that The calendar's okay as is, except for November.
Thanksgiving is the 28th, yeah.
So that can stay a Wednesday. I'll just remove the, change that to November 20th and remove the Wednesday.
So it's going to be on the 20th and
November 20th.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the Humanity County Board of Supervisors 2013 regular meeting calendar as presented, which would be the one on November the 20th.
Correct. I just changed that.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. Alderman. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Item M.
Amendment of the bylaws, really only one significant change, and that was on the work sessions. So pull the bylaws up here just to show you. Nothing significant change throughout any of the sections on here until we get down to the work session, where we added work sessions to be held on the first Wednesday of each month at 6 p.m. in the Nevada Circuit Courtroom. Now, that's the only change. Now, there were some word changes. I put some editing on there, and I worked with Mr. Payne on to make sure that the citations of the state code were correct. In one case, it had a misplaced number on there, so it's just been corrected. But the rest of the bylaws are essentially identical to last year's.
Any discussion? Is there a motion?
I move to adopt the Humanity County Board of Supervisors bylaws, rules of practice, and procedure.
Second. Motion made by Mrs. Booker, seconded by Mr. Chesser. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Moving on to regular meeting.
The only thing we're missing is the committee.
That's every 2 years.
That's every 2 years. We'll sit for the next one.
They'll stay as they are. We can revisit those anytime you like. We're set for 2 years at a time. That was changed a couple years back to go for 2 years running, and that way you can revisit some of that.
Okay, moving on to the special presentation, it's a post-election economic outlook by Mr. Terry Ruffin, Republican Senate.
Greetings. I'm a regional economist at the Weldon Cooper Center, and many of you may be familiar with the Weldon Cooper Center. We interact quite a bit with state and local government and some of the constitutional officers. The revenue and treasurers receive certification through one of our employees, Hal Spengler. I'm here to talk about the economy and also the revenue outlook, and also compare and contrast your local locality with the state and also the Thomas Jefferson Planning District. I gave a presentation a few weeks ago to a public training session at the Thomas Jefferson Planning District. And at that time, we talked about the economy and some local trends, economic trends, and revenue trends from a district perspective. And we also talked about the fiscal cliff and what the ramifications for that might be for the local and state economy. And since that's happened, I was a little disturbed this morning to wake up and see that my presentation was already dated, because the fiscal cliff has been resolved, or at least partially resolved. And so I had to frantically run some new numbers for you to incorporate what are, some of the figures are fairly ambiguous at this point, but I did incorporate them to the best of my ability. So anyway, this is going to be divided into several parts here. We're going to briefly look at some of the national economic trends. I'm sure just from reading the newspapers, you're going to be familiar with a lot of this information. But I think it forms a background for discussing some of the other bullets here, and that is the planning district in Fluvanna County, recent economic performance, because you're linked to the state and national economies. You're not these little isolated islands. And the economy, of course, is linked to your local revenue performance, and we're going to show some of those trends and how they relate to some economic measures. Then we'll get into the fiscal cliff and some details about the agreement that Congress and the President came up with. And next, look at what the impacts of that agreement are on the economy and revenue. And then we'll end up with just some overview. So anyway, I don't know if you've ever taken a class in principles of economics. Probably some of you have, but one of the key equations, one of the drivers of aggregate demand in the economy are the four expenditure components: consumption, investment, government spending, and net exports. And the biggest by far is personal consumption expenditures, as you can see there. But the most volatile component is investment. And one of the things that laid us on our back this last time was residential investment spending in the housing market. We experienced a bubble for a variety of reasons. One is Fed policy, very loose Fed monetary policy. And when they began to tighten up on that, it exposed some of the shenanigans going on in the financial sector, in addition to decreasing spending on housing. So it was really a double whammy. This graph here just shows you GDP growth over the last several years. And it shows that, you know, these different components, these different expenditures, some of them are going up, some are going down. In a healthy economy, most of them are going up at the same time. During this recovery, what's been happening is that some have been going up, some have been going down. Sometimes we've been firing on one or two cylinders instead of four, six, eight cylinders. As I mentioned, residential investment spending is a big reason for the downturn, and you can see that in that negative contribution to GDP growth there in the early stage. More recently, in the last few quarters, it's actually been contributing a little bit to growth. Federal government spending has also been something that's been cushioning the recession in the early stages, but more recently, it's not made much of a contribution to growth. Personal consumption, you can see there during the recession, it was really, really falling pretty rapidly there. But during the recovery, it's been going pretty well. And the thing that a lot of this has been fueled by the tax decreases and the Federal Reserve's policy with regard to quantitative easing, the various stages of that. Okay, so it's been going pretty good, even though personal income hasn't been increasing that much, which is pretty unusual. I mentioned the Federal Reserve policy and what that has done. Here's a visual graphic that shows you what quantitative easing is all about, and it just jumped. The money supply jumped by a factor of about three over a few years. Now, the Fed has announced that they're going to institute another phase of quantitative easing and buy long-term and short-term securities to the tune of about $80-90 billion a month over the next year until the unemployment rate gets below 6.5%. So that will take us up another trillion or so, and the question then becomes, well, how do we come back from there? And a lot of economists have doubts that we will be able to do that smoothly. This is what has happened to various types of interest rates and bond yields because of quantitative easing. And you see there the three-month treasury is virtually zero. And the consumer, the mortgage rates, they're as low as they've ever been in the history. Now, if you're a saver, you know, that's if you're on a fixed income and you have, savings and different types of certificates of deposit and stuff, that's really bad news. But if you're a borrower, it's great news. And so we have these transfers from creditors to people that demand money. From savers to everyone else. This is what private balance sheets have looked like over the course of the recession and the recovery, and they've been gradually repairing. Okay, of course, the housing prices depreciated pretty rapidly, unprecedented drop in residential property values. Gradually, people are working off their debt. They're giving up on their mortgages walking away from their homes. And so gradually, their debt is being drained, and they're also saving more. On the other hand, The public balance sheet is has been disrepairing, and we've been going into more and more debt. And this graph here shows two scenarios. One is if we had allowed nothing to happen, and we would have went over the fiscal cliff, and that would have had long-term positive ramifications for our debt load. If we had just suspended the fiscal cliff and continued forward, we would be looking at debt levels that were unsustainable. And one economist, Ken Rogoff, has estimated that if we get above 90%, it would have a significant detrimental effect on our growth rate. Now let's take a look at some of the local data on how we've weathered this. And Flavanna, as you know, is not only not an island in the economy, but it's very, very closely integrated with the metro area, Charlottesville and Albemarle in particular. And what this graph just shows is that you've come to be more and more a residential bedroom community over the years. Okay, more and more. You started out less than half of your local earnings came from outside the area. Now it's closing in on about 70%. So that just means that what happens here is very heavily dependent on what happens in the rest of the metro area and the district. Population growth, you see what's happening in Flavanna relative to the district, state, and nation. And there in the 80s and 90s, as you were building out in some of your major subdivisions, it was going great guns, and now you've really fallen below the other benchmark regions. This is a graph that shows employment and population change for Flavanna and the metro area, and you can see that, well, you know, your local employment's very, you know, it's volatile. It depends on closings of particular plants or openings. You know, whatever happens to the Dominion Power Station, they're supposed to go to natural gas, and they'll furlough 20, 30 employees. It shows up as a little bit of a spike in these types of graphs. But your population growth, it tracks more the Charlottesville MSA employment. But through the 80s and 90s, it grew more rapidly because you were building out those subdivisions, building out Lake Monticello and places like that. Your unemployment rate, virtually identical to the Thomas Jefferson Planning District, because everyone works within the region. They can, if they lose their job, they can find another job in the region. And so the economic vitality of the region really determines how well your residents do. And here's how employment growth has looked over the last few cycles. And you see that both Virginia and the Charlottesville metro areas have done pretty well relative to the nation because of the nature of their economies. They're very heavily dependent on federal government military and civilian spending, which can be a good thing most of the time. But as we'll see shortly, it can also have a downside, which the area hasn't experienced yet. This is a graph that shows how you're performing relative to the nation in per capita income. And it also shows how you're doing relative to the Albemarle and Charlottesville benchmark. They're at the top there. They're at about 110% of the national average. And so everyone's been climbing upwards, converging to, you know, toward 100% and above. But actually, Flavanna, if you look closely, is at the bottom of that pack. Retail sales tax, this shows you what's happening in the district, Virginia and Flavanna, and everyone most recently has been going up pretty considerably, concomitant with the recovery that we've been having. Not quite sure what that spike is early in 2000, 2003, 4. It may be a data error, I'm not sure. Recent performance is pretty much consistent with what's happening in the state and the district. Building permits, state and the nation have been uptick. They're in a bit of an uptick here. It's still relatively flat if you extrapolate the permits for 2012. Here's what it looks like if you break it out by locality, okay, by number of permits issued. And you see Albemarle is a pretty significant chunk of that. That's actually Albemarle and well, that's Albemarle. It doesn't include Charlottesville. Charlottesville is in the other category there, along with Nelson, I believe. Okay, here's if you break it out, those permits by percentage. And actually what's happening is some of the outlying regions have sort of lost the market share in housing permits there. Here's another graph that shows you standardizing the number of building permits by per 1,000 residents. And so you can see Flavanna was sort of the building region of choice back in the late 90s, early 2000. And it was really displaced by Louisa County, relatively speaking. And most recently, what is it, what's in the, I guess, green is in first place now, though it's not much to brag about because it's relatively low level there, but it looks like Flavanna is now last there as well.
But in 07 and 08, building permits were around 425. Now we're down to about 75.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's consistent with what we're seeing in those graphs there. Now, one of the most painful parts, particularly for localities, you know, what happened to real estate prices, housing prices plunged, and you can see that in this graph here, the changes in housing prices. And for Virginia, U.S., and Charlottesville, they're pretty close. Charlottesville is sort of lag going into the decline, and it's lag coming out a little bit, but you're getting to the point where prices are stabilizing. Of course, these are based on appraisals of a certain category of mortgages that are funded by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And of course, assessments will lag appraisals. So, just one more slide about recent economic changes, and I'll get back to the real estate changes because a few more points I want to make about that. But in this economy, what has happened is that industries that you're concentrated in, like healthcare services and educational services, because UVA Medical Center, Martha Jefferson Hospital, obviously UVA, to a lesser extent Piedmont Community College, a few other entities. Those sectors have grown pretty well throughout the recession, as they have in the rest of the nation and also the state. On the other hand, you look at construction, manufacturing, they've lost ground, and also retail trade there. So the economy, local economy, is even more of what we call an eds and meds economy, highly dependent on those two sectors, and anything that affects them is going to have a multiplicative effect on that those supply chain industries and the places where the workers go to buy things, services, and retail trade. In fact, I estimate that upwards of a third, 30-40% range of your local economy is due to eds and meds. So consequently, something like healthcare reform is very important, particularly if it increases demand for healthcare services. Okay, let's look at some revenue patterns here. And this is a slide I obviously developed for the planning district, and it shows about two-thirds of their revenue, local revenue, comes from the locality, the local taxes and fees. And the rest, another big chunk, about a quarter, from state aid, and the other is federal aid, the residual. And local revenue is made up mostly of real property taxes. So that housing market price collapse has had obviously very detrimental effects on the revenue performance of the localities here. If you look at Flavanna, and this is from the comparative report off of the Virginia Auditor Public Accounts website, shows that your revenue sources are a little bit different. And I was a little surprised by this. It's quite different from the district. You rely more on state aid, presumably because of the educational formulas used. Local revenue, about half. And if you look at your local sources of revenue, you're a little bit less reliant on real property. is a portion of that pie, and you don't have some of the taxes like hotel, motel, and meals taxes that some of the other localities have. This is what the district-wide those revenues have looked like, you know, local portion going down, driven by that real property decrease, but also state aid going down. But making up a little bit for that was an injection of federal aid in the last few years. Here's where, how Fluvanna looks like. And again, you know, it reflects that pie chart, your different sources of revenue, but you're hitting the same way on state aid, but your local portion has gone up a little bit. Federal aid has gone up proportionally more than the district. Here's when we translate those numbers to rates of change, and there you see the federal aid, even though it's a relatively low portion, it skyrocketed with the fiscal stimulus. On the other hand, it's also gone in the reverse direction since then. And depending on how sequestration plays out, it could go down significantly more in the next few years. And here's Fluvanna County, and I used the same scale there because I wanted to just show you how it looks, relatively speaking. And of course, it jumps off the chart. It jumps up to 100% increase in federal aid. But this is just a graph that shows you, you know, how your local revenue sources have changed year to year, the amounts. And here's what's happening in the district for these different types of taxes, tax revenue. And here's how yours looks. And you'll notice your real property tax has gone up at least through fiscal year 2011. I don't have, you all know what 12 looks like, but I don't have that data in hand. Now, what does that mean? Well, a lot of the other localities, according to this graph, have already seen their real property revenues decrease, okay? But a lot of those communities are in one-year assessment cycles. Green is on a two-year, and you and Nelson are in a four-year. So what that means is that, oh, you're on a six-year. Okay. So that means that those property value decreases haven't fully hit you yet, but they will. And this just shows you how some of the, what I'm calling consumer taxes have performed over the business cycle, and they decrease. They're very closely linked with personal income growth in the district. It's an amazing graph. They almost overlap each other. Growth in personal, local personal income almost overlaps with the tax revenue from these sources. And sales and use is a relatively small portion of your local revenue, but you can predict it pretty accurately using these types of figures. Okay, so let's look forward a little bit here and talk a little bit about the fiscal cliff. And this is what could have transpired if we had went over the cliff, and it would have been a contraction of about $500 billion in federal expenditures and tax increases in a one-year period. And about a fifth of that would have been spending decreases, the other four-fifths tax increases. Now, what I've highlighted in red here are things that are going to go ahead as of yesterday, according to the agreement. The things in black are the things that have been squelched or dealt with as part of this budget agreement. Okay. American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012, in the early hours of yesterday, the Democrats and Republicans, or at least some of the Republicans, agreed to pass a bill that that curtailed some of the Bush tax cuts and made permanent some aspects of it. But as part of that deal, the debt limit wasn't increased, and there is still some uncertainty about how some of the provisions would be enacted. There's some uncertainty in pertaining to the language of the act. Okay. One of the points I made in the Thomas Jefferson District presentation, that there's a little bit of hype with the fiscal cliff, associated with the fiscal cliff. You know, everyone likes a football game. Everyone likes, needing to throw that pass within the two-minute drill for the touchdown. And Congress probably didn't do the equivalent of throwing that deep pass in the winning moments of the game. But they did get a safety or maybe a field goal out of it. Okay, a lot of these things, a lot of the drama associated with some of these things is sort of artificial because Congress has always kicked the can down the road, so to speak. They've always done the dock fix, as I'll get into the details. They've always patched the alternative minimum tax. They've always extended the tax extenders. That's why they're called tax extenders. They get extended indefinitely. And another point worth making is the fiscal cliff policies. Well, some of the things have already happened. As part of that previous budget agreement, the sequestration, there were discretionary spending caps imposed. So a lot of the departments already have had to curtail their spending activities. And also some of the Affordable Care Act provisions have already, some of the spending decreases associated with that have already happened. Some of the components would have been spread out throughout the fiscal year, and businesses and governments have already anticipated the fiscal cliff and adjusted their behavior and curtailed their spending, their investment spending, their plans for hiring, their agency budgets, what they're spending. Sequestration from the vantage point of Virginia is very important because of the federal military spending and also civilian spending. That's a big chunk, about a 20%, 100 billion plus. And what makes that so important, because the spending associated with this has what's called a high economic multiplier, because unlike the tax decrease, tax decrease, it goes into consumers' pockets. They can decide to save or spend. In fact, they save an awful lot. The payroll tax decrease, consumers saved the bulk of that. So it didn't go actually back into immediate spending. If you don't buy procure a new airplane, a new jet, or a new artillery system, then that's money taken out of the economy, and those businesses have to curtail their hiring, lay people off. That's spending that doesn't occur. Okay, as part of this agreement, last year, sequestration, the Budget Control Act of 2011, approximately $2.1 million in savings were supposed to occur, which was equivalent to the amount of the debt ceiling increase. And it was supposed to be divided equally between defense and non-defense discretionary spending. There are a lot of people very wary about this. It was not wrapped into this current agreement, but there was a two-month delay put on the enactment. Payroll tax increase, well, it's actually going back to the status quo of 6.2 employee payroll tax rate, but you can see for about 2 years we had a reduction to stimulate the economy, and that was enacted back in 2010 as part of the Obama GOP tax deal. Affordable Care Act taxes, taxes on income, investment, and also medical devices, and there's just a whole grab bag, potpourri of taxes connected to that, approximately $18 billion. These three things are part of the current budget agreement. They're going to go forward, basically, though the sequestration has a couple of month reprieve. Bush tax cuts, alternative minimum tax, that was a big chunk, almost half of the fiscal cliff. And instead of being about $221 billion tax increase with this deal, it's probably more like a $40 to $50 billion tax increase, mainly on wealthier upper-income taxpayers. But it will probably hit most people to some degree.
Could you give this a little bit more, because I, you know, there was a couple of, and maybe you're a little bit more ahead of the curve on this than I am, but the Brookings Institute had something out, and it was pretty much, if you're making $50,000 and stretch it out, your average tax increase is going to be about $1,635. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you got other folks coming out, I guess, the New York Times, the Living Law, I guess, back and say, no, it's not really the case. It's going to be a net win if you're making under $450,000. We need to go ahead and talk about some of the reductions for, you know, obviously, if you're making more than that, which usually happens for deductible giving and things like that for nonprofits and whatnot. So, could you talk about the reduction?
Well, you know, I haven't looked at any of those websites. Every think tank has a different sort of a calculation engine where they make different assumptions and have different models. They're sort of different micro-simulation models, they're called. And I really don't have any more information than that. I guess the Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, they're probably, I wouldn't think of the New York Times as, you know, really, they're not really like a research corporate organization. They're journalists. That would be, I would look at their website, and I think they have an engine that will calculate what your tax liability will be given different, you know, it depends on different deductions that you use. It depends on a lot of different things. It's not just the income level, obviously. And it also depends on these tax extenders and some of the Obama tax cuts associated with the fiscal stimulus. So they're all sort of wrapped in to this thing. Okay. Emergency unemployment benefits, that's something that was extended as part of this agreement, and you can just see how the unemployment insurance benefits skyrocketed during the recession, and they've come down since then. It's about $26 billion. The sustainable growth rate of the Doc Fix, this was an effort to get Medicare, primary care, and office visits under control, the costs of that under control. And so they developed a formula to basically increase the spending at a rate similar to just slightly above the growth in gross domestic product. And that, as I mentioned before, has always been suspended. Alternative minimum taxes is an effort to make sure that the very wealthy pay some minimum level of tax, and because they didn't index the exemption, the basic exemption, it has captured an increasing number of taxpayers with each passing year, so there's a more urgency to patch it year after year, because at this point it would bring in approximately 30 million taxpayers, and so this is something that again was patched with this budget agreement. Tax extenders, just a veritable grab bag of tax credits for individuals, businesses, energy companies, community development efforts, disaster relief. Okay, now to summarize the fiscal cliff agreement. This is basically what I've already talked about. Bush tax cuts are largely preserved. Alternative minimum tax is patched. Many tax extenders, from what I can read, were extended. It looked like all of them, but it's a little uncertain reading the brief summary at the Congressional Budget Office's website. The Doc Fix extended for 1 year, and Emergency Unemployment Insurance Program is extended for another year. On the other hand, sequester delayed for 2 months, payroll tax holiday is over, and Affordable Care taxes will go ahead. Now, if you looked at some of the estimates of what the fiscal cliff effect would be on the economy, a lot of people are saying it would throw it into the recession. Most forecasts showed that it would be recessionary, though they showed different magnitudes of the severity of the recession. And the reasons for that is they have different models and they use different scenarios. They had different assumptions about the data that went into it. Here are some of the numbers that were bandied around, but you can see they're within the 3 to 5% range there of economic impact generally. But that's the past. We need to look at the future. One thing that is still on the table is sequestration, and Virginia is much more vulnerable to federal cuts. And if you look at some results from other research outfits and organizations, they say, well, the Center for Regional Analysis and Chemory Analytics says that 200,000 jobs could be affected just by sequestration. Fiscal Cliff, the American Action Forum, they had an estimate in the range of 30 to 225,000. That's a pretty big range. I'm going to present some results of some modeling that we do with a model that we have called Regional Economic Models Incorporated Policy Insight, and we're going to feed some numbers in from this most recent Taxpayer Relief Act. And I'm also going to show you what might have happened with falling off of the fiscal cliff to give you sort of a benchmark of what could have occurred. And this shows you three things. One is everything had been allowed to be fixed. There were no spending decreases or tax increases. Intermediate, the agreement that they came to, and then the fiscal cliff. And you can see the bottom one that it goes down, employment goes down. And so that's a recessionary effect. If you look at the agreement, it looks like it goes sort of flat for a year and then starts going up again. Let's convert that into rates of change. And we see here that indeed if we had gone off the fiscal cliff, Virginia would have been thrown into a recession. And it would have been greater, at least in magnitude for a year, than the Great Recession, the housing bubble recession. But it would have been a shorter duration. Now, with the agreement, employment growth slows a little bit, slows substantially over last year, but it doesn't decrease. So there's still employment growth in Virginia. Here's the impact relative to a baseline, that baseline that I described earlier. What the fiscal cliff would have cost us was about 250,000 jobs by 2014. And we would have recovered slightly to 230,000 by 2022. It's less than half of that with the budget agreement. And when you compare rates of change for the budget agreement for Virginia and the U.S., you see that we are hit a little bit harder than the nation at large, and that's because of our concentration of federal and civilian and military spending in the state. Long-run trend, this is with the agreement. You can see that, we go down a year, then we bounce back. But sort of the long-term trend is slower growth. If you look back in the 90s, early 2000s, we had 3 to 5% growth in a lot of that. Well, we're not going to see a return of that. We're looking at, between 1.5 and 2.5, probably, for the next 10 years. So we need to get used to that slower growth and labor markets that clear a little slower than we're accustomed to. Unemployment rates that stick in the 5 to 7% range for much of the decade. State revenue forecast, well, the governor's come out with his estimates. The governor's advisory committee on revenue estimates releases estimates at least once a year. And they show revenues slowing from about 5.5% to 2.5% in 2013. My estimates using REMI show it a little bit higher than that, but naturally they want to do conservative budgeting, so they tweak their numbers because they don't want to overshoot and then have to next year make serious adjustments in taxes and expenditures, so they're more conservative in their estimates. So what does the agreement imply for the local area? Well, your economy here is not relatively as dependent on federal spending as a state because of Northern Virginia. You know, it's highly dependent on federal spending in the Hampton Roads region. It is a little bit more dependent than the nation on federal spending, but the way Thomas Jefferson Planning District will perform is probably going to be pretty similar to the nation, a little bit faster growth than the state. And this shows you how it would have looked with a fiscal cliff, and so the local region would have been thrown into a recession similar to the state. And there you see business as usual. Everything had all the tax increases have been wiped out, and all the spending decreases have been wiped out. That's what I'm calling business as usual there, and we would have experienced pretty good year growth if that had happened. And so we're with the agreement.
Would it be safe to assume that once we get 60 days out, if we get the sequestration, that number would be somewhere in between those two?
Well, the agreement does take into consideration the sequestration. Well, I'm assuming that it goes ahead as scheduled, that they can agree as part of this debt limit, debt ceiling increase. It has been timed to occur at the same time. So I think the GOP thinks they have some leverage over sequestration in dealing with that. But, you know, not everyone in the GOP agrees that we should do away with sequestration. They feel that, you know, we need to get spending under control, and this is one of the ways to do it. Here's how employment looks. It's with the agreement, you know, it slows a little bit for a year, and then it's upwards again. So, you know, maybe a little bit of a slowdown over the next year, but then things resume. Here's what the impacts will be on some of those consumer tax revenues. And so with the fiscal cliff, it would have been a more dramatic drop, but not catastrophic by any means. And with the agreement, it's, you know, it's very manageable sort of thing. On the other hand, if sequestration occurs, there are going to be some direct cuts to localities and a number of different programs that maybe you're involved with that could be affected. This is just a short list. You probably find many more at the National League of Cities, National League of Counties, National Association of Counties, and the ICMA, International County and Business, City and County Business Managers Association website. They have a lot of good information. So, in conclusion, what can we say about all of these graphs and the data that I've flung at you here today? Well, as you're well aware, this area has weathered the storm, the previous storm, much better than the U.S. Unemployment rates lower, personal income holding up pretty well relative to the nation. One of the things looming for the state, not so much as potentially catastrophic for the region, is that sequestration is going to result in a lot of decrease in federal spending, and Virginia will be impacted much more negatively than other states. Yesterday's fiscal cliff agreement does avert a recession this year, but there will experience some slowing. And even with averting this fiscal cliff, we face the prospects of slower growth over the next decade than we experienced what we're accustomed to and based on the 90s and much of the 2000 decade. Now, Fluvanna County, you're quite a bit different than the district and what your revenue sources are, and so your revenue outlook is somewhat bleaker. Then, you know, Albemarle, Charlottesville, they can see light at the end of the tunnel. That light at the end of the tunnel that you see is a oncoming locomotive, because your real property assessments are going to readjust, and you're looking at significant downward adjustments there. You're also obviously more dependent on those federal and state sources. It looks like state should be basically okay, that you're not going to be hit too hard there. So that should be pretty reliable over the next several years. But federal is obviously some of these programs is an area for concern. And since you are becoming more of a bedroom community, that means that, you know, it's always great to have an industrial base because it carries residential. Residential traditionally doesn't carry its own weight. It's great to have power stations that have huge assessments. If you could get four or five more of them, that would be great, you know. Otherwise, you're looking at, you know, tax increases and cuts over the next several years. So I guess I was supposed to soften you up before the real bad news here later in the session. but if you have any, that wasn't my intent. If you have any questions or comments or any way I could help, just let me know.
I mean, it's not a recession, quote unquote, but it's all bar close. 0% growth isn't exactly a hallmark. Is that, I mean, you've already talked about how that's not exactly, you know, sort of a statewide effect. Obviously, the Hampton Roads in Northern Virginia, you're going to see much more of an impact than here. I mean, I know that I asked this question at TJBDC, so I was just going to go ahead and see if we could get, or see if I would get a similar answer. But in terms of actually, you know, investing in some sort of infrastructure and things of that nature, I mean, is it blanket to say that, you know, growth's dead for the next 5 years, don't try, or is it more accurate to say regionally you're going to see lift in certain areas where you're going to see impressions in others?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like if you extrapolate some of those lines we looked at, it looks like actually Albemarle is doing pretty well. It looks like the growth, it looks like some of the growth impetus or thrust is going down I-64 and maybe toward Louisa, and I'm not quite sure. You know, it has a lot to do with residential commutes. It has a lot to do with housing quality, availability, new housing, those sorts of things. And, you know, you're just about built out at Lake Monticello, I think. I don't know what else is going on. And maybe that's not such a bad thing. Maybe you could use a break and get your fiscal house in order and, you know, move forward. But, you know, I do think, you know, if you've been using a certain set of assumptions in the past of high growth, you could, for your capital improvement planning, you probably should curtail them a bit. But, you know, I don't know what the magical number is. I don't have a crystal ball.
So, I mean, but boiling it down for a policy perspective for us, I mean, obviously one of the questions we're dealing with right now is water. Whether or not we should actually bring that in Science Crossroads. So the real question for us is, you go ahead and invest in infrastructure in the short term in order to get that long-term result so you're not putting as much pressure on the residential taxpayer, or do you hold back and say that sort of investment is an effective waste of money, that's something that just doubly burdens the residential taxpayer and therefore probably not wise this investment of money in a rate stagnation sort of scenario?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to.
I mean, it's for us, that's really the great debate right now. Mm-hmm. Putting all the residential taxpayers, let them shoulder it for the next 5 years, or do you try to do some sort of you know, regional development in places where it makes sense in order to ride it out? I mean, obviously, you know, debt scenarios are what they are. You know, borrowers are probably willing to make out a little bit more than savers at this point, but. You know, that's really the intention for us. And so for policymakers at our end, you know, the real question is, do you invest in that sort of infrastructure or you step all the way back and say, let's ride out the storm?
Yeah, I guess the question is, what are you trying to attract industrial development, and is it a build it and they will come sort of a argument made in favor of the investments? I mean, you have lots of options with, you know, in terms of water, you know, different plant filtration, dissolved air flotation investments, and you know, ways to make existing water go further. I mean, there are ways around building additional capacity, just investing in new technology, I guess, and changing the rate structures to encourage people to economize. So, you know, something like that, I think, if you're making, and no doubt you have enlisted, you know, consultants that that can answer those questions, and that's probably the best route to go. But, you know, the only thing I would say is that don't expect the frenetic pace of growth, the growth that you saw over the last 20 years, over the next 10. Choose some intermediate, obviously not decline, but you know, some intermediate value, I think, in planning would be justified.
But when you bring up growth, you never bring up the composite index and the effect that it has on the revenue. And I realize those people who are determined to do some of these things do not like to hear that. But the county loses money with the composite index as it goes up. And why is that not presented along with how much revenue we get by business and growth? And why are those two not combined together to show a realistic bottom dollar what we really get?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Mr. Weaver is asking specifically about the impact of growth on the locality as it relates to the local composite index. Obviously, the more locality grows, the less you get from the Commonwealth because it factors in the deal. And that's revised over the course of a reassessment. So, more specifically, it's you know, if you go ahead and you grow, you get less money from the state. So the state's a more stable area of revenue recovery or income, for lack of a better phrase, rather than volatile increasing property values. What's the sense in growing if you can rely upon broader, more stable state money? All right?
So we're, yeah, absolutely. And that's what I wonder when we talk about economic development, why that's not put into the picture.
Yeah.
But the composite index is based on years. It's not
every. It's every 2 years it's reevaluated.
Composite index. Composite index,
when
you're talking about
the
finance and schools
and
things like that.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about the composite index, which determines how much state aid we're going to get per student.
Sure. Right, schools. And that's not determined until this
Level
of the one that we have now is based on 2008 or 2009.
We're
always behind. The next one, we're always so much behind. So. I don't know. I mean, that's
a good
indicator, but I don't know how it
could be. We were like 0.38, 0.37, where we were getting a much larger slice of the pie from the state than we are now. So as that goes up, we get less things from it. And we never talk about that. I mean, I'm bringing it into discussion now, but I don't understand why, especially from your perspective, that you don't bring the whole picture into it rather than just one side of the issue.
I really don't have any perspective on that particular issue.
It's part of the formula.
Right, but you know, it's not a one for one trade off. I guess you know, depending on the character of the growth, you probably get more from that. You know,
is it worth another 10% for this amount of growth, knowing we're not going to get the 40% growth because of the composite index? So then you assess that. Mm-hmm. Then it's a different assessment.
Yeah, but I don't have enough experience really to be able to answer that question. You know, what is an appropriate
state and national pretty much here, and to get down to, you might say, idiosyncrasies of Virginia. I'm sure each state is different.
Yes, I come from Maryland, and our revenue situation is quite different in a lot of different ways. But
so I've always been interested in full, complete answer to that issue rather than just one side.
Mm-hmm.
And as to whether they neutralize each other, I suspect they don't. But I'd like to know that difference.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
Any other questions from the board?
Thank you very much.
Very much.
Moving on to the county administrator's report. It's a very abbreviated report since the end of the presentation today. The sheriff's office and the fire rescue team have accomplished the goal of being compliant with the mayor manning requirement as of January 1st. And so it's good to go, and we appreciate the sheriff's and the fire and rescue team's hard work on getting all the portable and all that's done in time, and we're on track. And as you'll see later on, we need lots of kudos for Barbara Warlocker and the amazing hard work she did on the debt refinancing, and we'll see the capital report at the same time, but the debt refinancing, timing was everything.
Yeah.
This year ain't good, but if you wait until we cost us $500,000. And so she'll cover that. She and the team from Morgan Keegan from our bond company, Mr. Herbert, really did a fantastic job. So well, was good for all of us. That's Navy for way to go. So, and then we're still working on a whole variety of things, of course, but I've abbreviated everything else out of here today just so I could get through the presentation on to the next items. Any questions?
Any questions for the county administrator?
Mr. Spiegel, Virginia. I'm not over the weekend. Mr. Hopkins is not here today, so I can't ask him for sure. I know that he talked to him on Wednesday or Thursday last week, but I just don't know what the final numbers are.
Did we hear anything from Department of Corrections?
EOC is just waiting to get the permit flipped over and to cover the right numbers. They're ready to go. They just have to have the permit codified for the larger, the higher amount. When they originally did a permit through the state, it was not recorded as the right total gallons per day, and so we're just waiting to get that done. They think it'll be done within 60 days and ready to go.
Okay, moving on to the first round of public comment, and please be able to keep on topic within 5 minutes and direct to the board. Is there anyone wishing to address the board? Seeing none, close the first round of public comment. We have no items for public hearing. We do have action matters, TAPI, Thomas Jefferson Water Resource Protection Foundation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, there are actually two items in a row here. I recommended a number of weeks ago to eliminate participation with or eliminate various boards and committees and commissions. Two of them, I just didn't have the right story on, and so I met with the Thomas Jefferson Water District folks, Allison Sappington, and our representative, Mr. John Easter, on the foundation, and discussed at length what the purpose of the group is and the benefits to the county. This is a function that we are have been participating actively with. Mr. Easter is an active member of the foundation and is the current vice president. And the cost to the county is zero, which is good, but we get the benefit of their work ongoing in behalf of the region. So I would recommend in this case, if you look at
the John Easter.
Right, Mr. Easter is our representative. And we limited a while back on our information, but I met with both of them. The board actually is a regional board, again, the foundation, and their work supports our county and supports the things we do, but without cost. And Mr. Easter is a really active member, and not vice president, he's associate director. But I would recommend we continue participation in that. I was just mistaken on the requirements.
I don't have a problem in that. Statement. I move to restore the Tubana County participation with the Thomas Jefferson Water Resources Protection Foundation Chapter Act of November
7th, 2012. Second. Second. Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. Smoker. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. We go on tab Q, Piedmont Workforce Investment Pool.
This one is much the same, Mr. Chairman, that what I didn't realize in this one is that again, we're trying to pull information together from a variety of sources and just did not have the right information list. I had not made the link, although Helen Cawthon, who's the president of the Towne-Chester Partnership for Economic Development, had talked about this before at meetings I've been at. I'm on that board. I just never made the connection that they were the same things. So the Piedmont Workforce Network and the Piedmont Workforce Initiative is managed by Towne-Chester Partnership for Economic Development. It's kind of a subset from a management point of view, but they do actually provide services for Fluvanna County citizens. You'll see on the information I provide you that about 100 people a month are served by the center in Charlottesville. I've actually been to the center. It's always busy when you're in there, every time I've been in there. But they also had about 1,200 residents last year seen. And then there are 15 residents Fluvanna, in their expanded training efforts where they get additional training and assistance. And that's a much more formal program. Now, they only have 175 clients in that program, but 15 of those are from Fluvanna County. Now, just historically, in 2008, when the Thomasville factory closed, they provided significant support to Fluvanna County in getting folks that lost their jobs there reinvested into the workforce and other alternative opportunities through training or through connection. Chris Fairchild, was the representative on the Piedmont Workforce Network Board. His term expired last summer, and we were headed towards not doing this, and we had no candidates to rebuild that position at the time. And so this is one of the reasons I recommended not to continue with the Workforce Investment Board. He has subsequently told Mrs. Cawthon and Heather Ford, who's the program manager of Piedmont Workforce Network, that he would like to be reappointed. I've got his application attached there, and we would just reinstate, we start his term as of now and then still end it at the original termination date of what that term would be, 30 June 2015. So the ultimate part here is that the Piedmont Workforce Network gets federal funds to do this program, and we are a signatory. I didn't have it, it was from 2008. We're a 2008 signatory on the regional agreement to support this function. And so while they don't ask for money from us, they didn't take money, but they didn't give any money last year, their goal is not necessarily after the money, although again they would gladly accept it for this function. What they're interested in is participation in the workforce network development program and supporting folks in our region who are looking for job skills and job opportunities.
Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to restore Fluvanna County participation with the Piedmont Workforce Investment Board retroactive to November the 7th, 2012, and to reappoint Chris Fairchild to that Workforce Investment Board.
Second. Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. Chester. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Mr. Weaver, so we need to move tab R as well.
Tab R, the reappointment is fine, that's the motion for it. And so as long as we already made that motion to reappoint, we can just accept that substantively the same language. It will terminate at
1:30. Mr. Chair, I was very pleased with the information that you gave the Virginia Workforce on how it does affect Fluvannians. But yet and still, I still felt that why didn't I know that? Why didn't we know that? Why did we eliminate something if we knew the works of that particular organization? I knew some people. I've known a person in this county worked for years there, but I just didn't have enough information of how important it was.
Yeah, two things, Mrs. Booker. A, again, I've been using this excuse all year, but truly it is kind of an ongoing excuse. A lot of us were just new. A lot of us were just new, and so we just didn't have to hold together. That's one of the reasons why on our website, we now have not only the boards and commissions and who's on them, it lists all down below all the details of each board and commission, who to contact, what the board purpose is, if there's an agreement to it. And so those will stay as updated as we possibly can. So the next time a new board member comes in or a new staff member comes in, you have questions, at least you know who to contact. In this case, when Helen Trothen called me, the president of the Thomas Jefferson Partnership for Economic Development, soon to be the Central Virginia Partnership for Economic Development, called me. She and Heather Ford came out and actually met with me and provided a lot of good information, information I didn't know either. I never made the connection, so I apologize. I should have at the time, and I should have just reached
out.
You're
out of town by you.
I know, but I should have picked up on that nuance, because I knew right. Mrs. Coffin was covering both things. They just didn't click. And partly, like in the Soil and Water Conservation right. District, well, that's different than the Thomas Jefferson Soil and Water Conservation Foundation Board. Right. And sometimes I'm not making those connections yet. So we'll do better on that, but for all of us, on our website now, there's a lot more information there about those individual things that I think will help all of us.
Perhaps at their convenience, maybe they can make presentations.
We have two old members of the board ship on campus.
Share an ownership of money and stuff.
That happens, yes.
My goodness gracious.
My workforce network did put in a request, a budget request for this year. We'll hear from them when we do the nonprofits and agencies presentations, and they'll cover these kinds of things. But Heather Ford is actually a really good resource for us because she's a Fulton County resident, too.
Very good. So moving on to the presentations, we have the VDOT report from Mr. Joel Pinsero.
Mr. Newball is the Charlottesville Residency Administrator. Just got promoted recently, and so pretty bad.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I think this is the second monthly update I've attended now, and last time I was just filling in, but now I am now permanently your VDOT representative. Starting off with the new year, what I'd like to do is offer an opportunity for me to come meet with each one of you if you would like, ride your roads. Listen to your concerns, show me the concerns. I think it would benefit me to help me understand more of the needs of Fluvanna County transportation needs and help us to address your transportation needs better. So what I'd like to do is send an email out to each one of you after this meeting, and if you would like me to come meet with you, I'd be glad to do that. We'll set something up January, February, as soon as we can. Moving on to our monthly report. Did everybody receive a copy of the report? I did something a little bit different on the top of this one. We put some accomplishments for Fluvanna County and VDOT for the past year. Five bullet points there. What we've done in 2012. There was a couple projects we did. It looks like actually the outlook for 2013 as far as construction is a little bit heavier than it was last year. If you see under the preliminary engineering phase there, we actually have four projects that will be going to advertisement towards the end of 2013 here. The 53 safety project, we have a unpaved road project, and a couple bridge replacement projects on Route 6. We expect that the unpaved road will be started and completed in 2013. The rest of them will probably begin construction more around the beginning of 2014 or the end of 2013. I also see under construction activities the 653 intersection roundabout that's currently under construction. We expect that to be complete April of 2013. And also under construction is the Route 632 Ballinger Creek bridge replacement. The construction hasn't actually started yet, but it got moved over to our construction division because the engineering is done with it and it's under advertisement right now. The only other thing I'd like to talk about, maintenance activities at the end of this report, we put this out just before last week. We did have a couple events last week where we mobilized our crews around here. We didn't get so much ice in this area, but a little bit farther west we did. But we did have crews out the day after Christmas through the night. Last week and also Friday and Saturday we had crews out just monitoring cold spots, bridges, any kind of water crossing to make sure that we didn't get icy spots on the road. And the day after Christmas is a little more significant than the Friday-Saturday event, but we did have crews out. So if that's the worst that we get this year, I'm very fortunate. We'll save a lot of money in snow costs if that's all we get. So I'm looking forward to that. So now, if you have any questions about this report or any requests you'd like to make for me to look into, I'd like to take this opportunity to do that.
Any questions from the board? I'd just like to say, I meet with Joel regularly, and we actually met at Fulton again last week, the week before last, and talked about a variety of responses. I haven't been there all along, but responsiveness is working. And I really appreciate it. It makes a big difference to me to get an answer fast back to citizens and to look at issues and to get back to the board. And he's really been very helpful for all of us. So I appreciate it.
Would it be appropriate to bring up again at around 6:20 where four people have been killed and got to sign a
Yeah, and the list that I gave to the university was before last, I guess.
Correct.
List one of the ones was specifically Route 620, and they put some use on it, but they missed that curve, and so
sure,
now,
yeah.
He now knows which one at Blumont, just past Blumont Lane there. And that one, probably, there was about five or six things we put on the list.
They need at least three going around.
Well, yeah, we reviewed that curve, and the curve we put warning signs on is actually a sharper curve with a worse vertical approach to it. The one closer to was at Blue Mountain Road that actually doesn't have a radius that has concern. But Steve and I talked about that last week and what maybe the problems were out there. I'm going to look at maybe seeing what kind of right of way we have out there. And in addition to maybe signing it, looking at if there's some shoulder improvements, because there's some thought that maybe the problem wasn't the actual curve itself, but people getting off the edge of the road.
There's four people being killed. Mm-hmm. Personally, know that there's a problem there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You see it or not,
the deaths are, I think, the accidents are almost exclusively going westbound towards Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're coming around that curve, you've got headlights in your face, and then the roadway is there. You touch the edge of the road, and then you overcorrect it all the other side. So they'll look at potentially some roadway improvements along the two as well as the sign.
Yeah.
Whatever way it is. And I'm not so sure that maybe that you shouldn't put some reflectors on the center going around that curve. At night time.
Mm-hmm. Right at 2:00 in the morning. I believe most of them were at night, weren't they?
Afternoon.
Okay.
Late evening.
Okay.
Another one was in the afternoon.
Okay. Yeah, we're gonna keep looking at that and make improvements out there.
Because from the time that I talked about this before, one person was killed, that we never got the signs up in town.
That was actually a different curve, though.
Same curve that I'm talking about. They're all four people killed in that one curve heading towards Kids Store.
I'll see the accident. But the reason the accident this last summer where the gentleman was killed was not the Blumont Lane curve.
I don't know about that.
It's only the stretch of road in Logan to Drive, the road between Willingdon and Kids Store. It was resurfaced back in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he hasn't come up there and done some preliminary repairs. I believe the only reason why it was patchwork was really more so because whatever we all set with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hopeful that somebody's going to come out there, but I'd love to get that email.
Okay.
That stretch of road, I want you to see what was done.
Okay.
The stretch between Fort Cliff and Kent Store was absolutely beautiful. The stretch between Kent Store
in
Wilmington looks like a war zone,
so. Okay. We will look at that.
I appreciate that.
All right.
Very much.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to CSA fiscal year 2012
overview. Okay. Okay, I just wanted to give sort of a brief overview of CSA spending in 2012. And this slide is probably one that I usually start with, which tells you the local share that of the services that we purchase and what we pay. So community-based services here you can see are the net 19% is the lowest. So we pay less money than obviously we pay for the residential services. So you try to use as many community-based services to meet the needs of the youth as you possibly can because it keeps your costs lower. Now, comparing FY11 to FY12, what this slide illustrates is that we have a high percentage, the numbers are going up in residential. The cost is, you know, as we move through the slide, you'll see the cost is going up also. So that's a trend that has been greatly affected by assessment and diagnostic placements, and as a result of the recommendations of those placements, residential services that extended beyond the 90 days of the assessment. Non-residential services are decreasing. That's really not the way we want to go, because if we, again, as I've mentioned, the more residential services you use, the higher the cost for the county. Now, I broke this down, expenditure by service, because most of in CSA language, statistics are always showed illustrated by service or by child count. So if you're looking by services, you can see that we used more services in FY12, and we used more expensive services. If you go towards the bottom of the slide, you'll be able to see that illustrates that we're using the higher cost services. Now again, expenditures by child, more children, but the cost when you get into the high dollar categories is going up, and that's what we've been affected by. This gives you your child count and service count. You can see the numbers there have risen. And, of course, again, as this all sort of follows along, the actual expenditures for residential placements have increased. And that is a significant increase. Now, this slide shows you the history of CSA. Of course, CSA started before 2003, but I didn't. So this is my history with the county, because some of the prior records were a little sketchy. But this shows you kind of how the expenditures have changed over the years, you know, how the child count has changed, and in comparison to adopted budget. So it's really has significantly gone up. And when you're seeing the difference, just keep in mind that, generally speaking, the average, because you're taking the community-based services, the residential services, and that all the figures from that first slide, they kind of average out a little bit. So say those differences in numbers come out to about 38% on an average, 35 to 38% of local dollars, and the rest would be what we get reimbursed from the state. Do you have any questions or comments? Pardon?
Do you think that state funding is going to stay stabilized, or do you look forward to the future on that?
I'm a little nervous from some of the things I'm starting to see, especially we had a budget line for community-based services for children that were basically special needs, had disabilities, but in school. So it was like the special education, and you know, but these would be children that used services in the community. And then we had community-based services, which we could also use for them. So, and we could also do some of the day placement activities that Region 10 runs in the school system. We could pay for that budget line, out of that budget line. And what the state did this year is they have what they call wraparound services for students with disabilities. So they have a new budget line. They said they added the budget line as we go back. They actually substituted one for the other. And this is now money that you're not, that's just not available. You have to, I can't call it a grant because it's not grant funded. It's a pool of money that you apply for. And then based on numbers and how they divide this, I think it's 2.5 million up amongst localities, your locality is granted a pot of money. And we got about $17,500. And then what happened was there were many localities that didn't get the memo, and so they didn't apply for the money. And so what the state did is they took the money they had left over and just distributed it amongst localities that did apply, so that we got a little over $9,000 more through that. But this is has been a real stress when it comes to young people in the schools that need services, because it adds up to something. I mean, somebody, it's about $27,000, which is really nothing when you're trying to get, you know, services for kids in the community. You could employ a counselor for a child for 6 months, and that alone could be like $10,500. So it really doesn't serve a lot of kids. It really has put the schools at a disadvantage because the schools don't have the resources and personnel to pick up the children that can't get the services in the community. So they don't have extra people to do counseling and groups and individual counseling and working with families and that kind of thing. So, and I've talked to the chief fiscal officer at Office of Comprehensive Services, and he feels that that number is not going to be raised. Of course, they're going to, the state, at the state level, they're going to try to get more than $2.5 million, but I don't think, given the financial state, that's really going to happen. So we're going to be very restricted next year, and that's one category in particular that I'm very concerned about. I'm also extremely concerned about the number of residential placements we've had last year, and it's continuing this year. Some of the issues in the community that, just personally, I don't feel that we're discussing as a community. I think I'm going to be talking to the board more about some of my thoughts on this. I think we don't really have a plan long term for how we're going to address some of these issues. I think we are desperately in need of this. I don't want to be kind of radical in my approach. I'm not saying this because of some of the recent incidences in Connecticut, but when you look at a community that's about the size of ours, and the what I read about this young man, and he's angry, which has been an issue that's come up repeatedly in the reports we get from our counselors that are working with the young people in CSA, and some of the other personality disorders, and we do have children in this community that have the same type of profile. They may have not acted out on it in the same way, but I really feel that we do have a level of risk. What that level of risk is, I don't know, but I do know our residential numbers are going up, and so the issues with the young people are more significant. And, you know, we had a trend for several years that I thought that the non-residential services, community-based, were able to meet most of the needs. You know, you're always going to have a group that has to go residential, but we were really working that. Our number was coming down on our average age of the child that served through CSA, and now it's shot up again. It was like 11.6, and now it's 12.6. So we're going in the wrong direction. And I'm working with CPMT and some professionals from University of Virginia that I've been in conference with that have come to speak to CPMT, and we're trying to come up with a plan on how we might address this, again, as a community, thinking about maybe public
regional,
forum.
About regional. Address it regional. We talked about this years ago. Are you still looking at that, or have you forgotten that concept?
Well, the thing about it being regional, and we have, of course, rural CSA meets every month, so we do talk about these issues regionally, and it is a regional concern. I think Charlottesville-Albemarle is light years ahead of us when it comes to public forums, focus groups, getting issues out on the table early, talking about suicide rates amongst young people and things like that. So I don't know there's just a comparison there, but they're not part of rural CSA. But if we move forward, and we're trying to get some professionals in, it may be that there's a cost involved, and everybody's feeling a financial, you know, the same financial stressors that we feel in Fluvanna, and how we proceed is going to be determined by what we can do for ourselves versus what we may have to have someone help us with.
And, Mr. Trump, one of the things that we need to be doing that I haven't seen much since I've been here is we've got Dr. Meyerstein, if we're talking about a specific issue. Then we get Mrs. Vera, if we're talking about a specific issue. Then we get the schools talking about a specific issue, when they ought to be talking together. I mean, we ought to collectively be briefing you as one team. Because what we do in the schools with the staffing and the number of school psychologists and things we have there directly impacts and affects what social services can do and what Dr. Meyer programs can do. And that consolidated approach, maybe we should put into school psychology so that then it helps impact here. But the three of them, their voice needs to be heard collectively.
We do meet. We all...
You do.
And we do.
You do, and away from groups. I'm talking about to the elected board of supervisors as a whole. And
are you seeing there's a lot of overlap then?
It's not that there's so much overlap. It's just that your story needs to be from all three perspectives at one time, because if you consider trying to put more money at CSA, and then you're going to try to consider putting more money at
I see that connection there. Maybe we're not talking. Maybe I'm not hearing. But I do.
Well, CPSD does meet. The Interagency Council does meet. But those groups don't present as a consolidated group effort to the Board of Supervisors. They're all stovepipes coming in several different times.
And the state now is 42% are... 62%, you think that's going to change?
No, I don't think that's going to change.
Maybe go down.
I think that they, there is always a threat of that. I think that's always there, because this is based on a calculation, and the state can change that if they get enough support for it. It's not that they can't. You know, they certainly could. I think the dollars and what they're going to put, I would not want to see them put restrictions on any budget line like they did with the wraparound service for students with disabilities. But if they did it once, it doesn't mean that it can't be done again, because they're concerned about the spending and the cost of residential from their side also.
I think we need to look at how does the child family get to CSA? Where do they come from? Social services, schools, community, and then we all communicate and all try to find out the best thing. So maybe if the board does not understand that whole process, maybe that is some kind of presentation that we need to talk about and see where is missing what Mr. Nichols is saying that you're not.
Well,
in
I think
that together. I think it is. Definitely needed, because you can see what the cost is doing. You can see
how
many more children.
Yeah, I mean, the mental health issue is something that's, you know, it's more than just the data. There's a lot of things that are involved with it. And obviously, the Commonwealth's got to do certain things as well. And it's way beyond my realm of competency. So, whatever I'm told to do is pretty much work it done. My question, in the previous slide, and this is maybe a little bit more esoteric, but maybe you can help me sort of out. You notice with the difference, you've almost got this oscillation. You go from 26 to 341, 58, 167, 99, 173, and then all the way back up to 314,000. Is there, you look at the numbers and you look at the child count, there's really not a correlation for that. Is that driven by the state budget, or is that...
I think it's affected by whether you're using the residential services and the non-residential services. Because if you can use the non-residential services, which isn't something in the community, and there were years, we didn't have nearly the services that we have now, because we have Elk Hill, we can go to the, I'm not talking just their day treatment or residential, but they do in-home services, mentoring, counseling, they do a variety of different in-home services. We have Family Preservation Services does a lot of counseling, and there's people that we have brought. We've got a Brown Youth Consultants that do mentoring, so we have places we could go. Some of these years we were sort of held hostage by one agency, or didn't had to go to try to convince people to come to Fluvanna. But these, I think, some of the oscillation is when you get this the residential, and it really just throws the budget completely out of whack, because there's no way, and this is sort of the irony of CSA, there's no way I can tell you, even though we're in a budget season, how many kids are going to need non-residential services next year, how many kids are going to be residential, are we going to have a suicide, are we going to have angry kids, are we going to have a homicidal child, are we going to have personality disorders, bipolar, any of this stuff. I have no idea. I don't know how many kids are going to be in foster care. You know, Susan could surprise me. But, you know, that's the whole thing. And that's why, you know, but the other side is I don't like when people say, well, CSA is a moving target, because it's really monitored. I mean, I don't feel like it's a crazy thing. We monitor. I work hard to try. And everybody does. It's not just me. It's FAPT and CPMT work hard to see how those dollars are spent and monitor how those dollars are spent. But we just never know who comes into the program. And also, the sad thing is, I really believe we only scratch the tip of the iceberg. I think there are so many kids in there out there that if we could get some family support systems going, we could get some mentoring, get some counseling, and do better identification of the kids that really are the, you know, walking time bombs, that have real issues that haven't been identified. But you know, the place to the really that sees all the kids is where it's a school. The school sees all the kids. But you've got to have enough staff to spend time and talk to these kids and monitor this and have people that can respond, have school psychologists. We have two school psychologists in the county, one for the elementary school and one does the high school and middle school. And with those kind of things, you can, and then they have to do testing. They have a huge amount of responsibilities that are with the testing and that kind of thing. That doesn't mean that just because they're school psychologists that they're able to spend all the time talking one-on-one with kids or doing groups in the schools and stuff. There's just not enough hours in the day.
So if you were to talk to Berlin Lights of prevention, is that pretty much where you'd start with the first line of defense would be? Okay, I shouldn't say first line of defense, it's not the right word, but the first avenue of assistance would be something along the lines of psychologists and school.
I think that is a huge, huge need, is to have support, you know, even one position, you know, more with school psychologists, because they make a tremendous difference. Our school psychologists right now, the two that we do have tremendous background. They really spend a lot of their own private time reading studies that I can't even believe. They step in and I read these studies. I don't. I watch Law and Order, but that's my problem. You know, but they really have a great background. They have worked in different systems, and they bring all that knowledge with them, and I think they make as big an impact as they can, you know, but they're two people. But schools are where you see all the children.
Rather than looking at studying the kinds of children that are coming into the system, Dr. Myers has done a complete, we have categorized, we know who's getting counseling, we know which family is in the deepest trouble, and trying to get a handle on how can we do some preventive work in the homes. We have our school psychologists trying to get a grant. We met several times to think we could get a grant to bring families together so that they could do things together in our schools and present different information to them. And our high school psychologist sent information to everybody when we had the Connecticut thing to prepare teachers, to prepare people. And that was quite great of her to take that time. But she knew that she felt that was her responsibility to be there. So I think we have done some good things, but I do think we have some other ways to go. And because it's very hard, when you sit in the meetings and spend $200,000 to $300,000 on a family or two or three children, and you wonder what could.
We could spend that much money on psychologists to help prevent that situation.
Right. Yeah.
Are there any? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on to tab T, sent by 12 comprehensive annual financial reports. So
welcome. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm going to give you some numbers from the comprehensive annual financial report, and then we have David Foley here from Robinson Farmer Cox. First of all, as an overview to FY12, We started FY12 with an overall budget of almost $68 million, with revenue coming predominantly, just as the man from Weldon Cooper told us about, from local funds, and secondly, from state funds. And then the next slide shows how we spend that money, or plan to spend the money. This is budget dollars. With 50% on schools and 37% about on the county, and then the CIP, and then other being things like the water and sewer funds.
Mr. Chairman, one note about this. Please note that expenditures from all revenue sources, this is both Barbara and I get bopped regularly about what slide says what and what numbers say what and what percentages say what. This is from all revenue sources. Then you can break it down to, you know, local revenue sources. Then you can break it down whole variety of ways, general fund versus other. So this one, we've tried to clearly identify these, so we're stating what the percentages are applied to here. In this case, all revenues from federal, state, local, and other.
And the definition of CIP would be debt service, or?
No, just the actual projects.
You know, I think that's unfortunate. That's not spelled out like you'll hear. And I realize they don't do it, and I've mentioned this before, but you know, you should have another 5 million really added on to the school system for the new school, which makes a big difference in that 51.3. And I realize, again, the state doesn't do that. But that gives you a little bit more impression of what we are doing to help the school system.
I think you're talking about the debt service number. That would be in the blue part, yes.
Why is the number of debt service?
I mean, there's a million ways we could break this down. This is just basically what we use to illustrate the FY12 budget. I mean, I could have made debt service another piece of the pie.
All the debt service in this pie is not accounted.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
So that 36% is not
really sorry. A lot of that, most of that was cool.
$6 million of that. If you have, and I pretty much know the number, but it's equal to 51.3%. It's really right at 60%. It's about 59 and change percent. If you had a debt service in there.
But as far as the debt service, 19% will go to that. So we're going to take out the 19%.
And well, this is the struggle that we went with in illustrating these numbers. Is it all depends on which pie you're looking at. So
it depends on which story you want to tell. That's why there's multiple versions in here that are clearly labeled.
There's only one story.
And none of them are stories. They're all facts. So
So
out of the local revenue, that was for the budget. Now, this was how the budget was played out, or laid out in FY12. Then real property tax was about 50% of that. Public utility tax, about 9%. Personal property, 11%. And there was a use of fund balance, about 18%. And then other, and that's all the fees and charges and things like that. So that's just kind of give you an overview of the what the plans were for FY12. Next, I will talk specifically to our annual financial report, where we look at things more on a general fund basis. That's our operating fund, our annual, where the tax revenues come in, and then we provide all the services to the citizens. So if you look at just the general fund, 67% of our revenues come from general property tax, and you can see the state comes in there second at 21%. A lot of that, and that's the state money that the general fund gets, so that is mostly for CSA and social services. And this is a breakout of just the general fund expenditures. And again, then you see education at 37%. Again, that's a different percentage, because we're only looking at the general fund. The 37% would be our contribution to the schools that we make every year. public safety, health and welfare, and debt service are also part of the makeup, the bulk of our general fund expenditures. Here I talk a little bit about the revenues, compare them to the prior year. Again, you see property taxes are our main source of revenue, with the state being the second. And then we talk about the top four revenues: real estate taxes, personal property taxes, public service corporation taxes, and that's when he said, you know, it'd be nice if we had a couple more utility companies. That's where you get your public service taxes, and then your local sales taxes. I think the local sales tax tells an interesting story, and that is that we see that for about 4 years there, they were very, very stable. That was the recession. And actually now in FY12, we've collected more sales tax than in any other year. Expenditures, again, you see that the bulk of our expenditures are in education, debt service, and public safety. And then the final results, the general fund, our fund balance went down overall about $500,000, still keeping our fund balance at the end of the year at $20.2 million. And of course, you know, we break out the fund balance in terms of what we can spend and what we've already committed. We've committed $9.8 million to mostly CIP projects, which you'll see in the next slide. And that leaves an unassigned fund balance of $10.3 million. And according to our fund balance policy, we'd like to keep it at $7.1 million. And these are all the projects, the 911 project being the largest project, probably the roundabout and Fork Union being the next two largest, but by far the 911 project being, and that is money that we've committed and set aside for those projects. And this is just a graphical of what I was saying earlier about the fund balance. Our policy says we need to keep a fund balance of 7.2. Right now it's about 10.4. And the committed is the yellow. And then on the right, we've just taken a stab at maybe where we'll be at the end of FY13, assuming all comes out the same, and then, of course, with the debt savings that we're going to have, the debt service savings that we're going to have this year. Just a little graphical of our fund balance. Our total fund balance has pretty much stayed the same over the last several years. The unassigned, of course, has gone down as we've committed more and more to different projects. And the sum of all our debt, with the bulk being our general obligation bonds of $77.8 million. As of June 30th, so.
In other words, July 1st is going to be different.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. And it'll be, yes.
Is GEO loan to private account?
What was that?
General obligation
bonds,
what are they divided into?
Oh, school bonds predominantly, the $66 million, and then the rest were other forms of VPSA debt that had been issued earlier. And literary fund loans were for schools. Public facility revenue bonds, that's the courthouse and library. And the revenue note, of course, was for early school expenses. That's been refinanced now. And then the capital leases are for mostly fire equipment, fire trucks, things like that.
Are you going to be handing out today the auditor's report?
David will speak to the auditor's report. I don't know if he brought copies or not.
I do have actual hard copies.
Oh, okay. You mean a bound copy of the...
Absolutely. We've always got... Actually, we've gotten as of August, but I realize your situation, so...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're printed today, but they are coming.
They're in the car. From,
okay. We want those. We'll get them after the meeting. And David will talk to the opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As Barbara said, my name is David Foley. I was an audit manager for this year's audit. Would like to go over our independent auditor's report, which is in page one of the financial section. In our auditor's report is where, in this report is where we state that the financial statements are the responsibility of management. It's also where we state that we conducted our audit in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards, and it's where we issue our opinion on the financial statements, and we have issued an unqualified opinion on the county's financial statements, which is the cleanest opinion an auditor can give on the set of financial statements. Basically, an unqualified opinion means that the county's financial statements have been prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. Also, in addition to our independent auditor's report, in accordance with government auditing standards, is where we issue we issued our reports over the county's internal control over financial reporting, and also on the county's compliance with its major federal programs. Those opinions both are back in the compliance section. Both of those reports were clean as well. We noted no instances, no significant deficiencies or material weaknesses in the county's internal control over financial reporting, and also noted no instances of significant deficiencies or material weaknesses over the county's compliance with its major federal programs. So again, both those reports were clean as well. Also, in addition to our reports that are included in the CAFR, auditing standards require that we make certain communications to you all at the end of an audit. There are six communications that we make to you all, and I would like to do that as I'm in front of you all today. The first one is related to the qualitative aspects of accounting practices. In that, we state that management is responsible for the use and selecting appropriate accounting policies. Also, we state that accounting estimates were used in preparation of financial statements. The two biggest estimates used in preparing the county's financial statements are the depreciable lives over the used for the county's capital assets and determining depreciation expense. Those useful lives are based on industry standards and also on prior data. The other estimate is on the other post-employment benefits, which that comes from an actuary. Another communication we have to make to you all is any difficulties we encountered in performing the audit. We had no difficulties in dealing with management and performing the audit. If we had any, we'd have to report that to you all. Corrected and uncorrected misstatements. Management's posted any journal entries that we had as part of the audit, which we had very, very few audit adjustments in performing an audit, which speaks to the strength of the county's finance department.
What kind of adjustments did you have this time?
Mainly it was we had some reclassifications between state and federal revenues. State and federal revenue, just revenue reclassifications.
Because historically we've had some big adjustments to make things balance. And we didn't know it for a long time, for several years. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars. And they just put an adjustment, balances, and just keep on going. We never could understand that.
All right. Certainly over the past, I've been working on the county's audit since 2007, I believe, was the first year that I took over. And we historically have not had, since 2007, there really haven't been many adjustments. Now, prior to that, I understand there were, big time significant adjustments, but that has improved substantially over the years.
But I never could understand how you balance it and make adjustments.
Right. Well, I mean, typically, if when we do have audit adjustments in places, I mean, there's the adjustment is used to correct it, and you understand what the issue was with the adjustment. But again, we haven't had significant adjustments to the county's financial statements over the past 5 years.
I think you got enough pushback on it that we were more careful and more precise in the future when you
allowed it. Right. And the county's done a much better job over the years. And the way auditing standards are now, they require that to be done even before we come in. Before you could come in to an audit and you'd have basically a cash basis set of books, no adjustments, no accrual adjustments were made. You could come in as an audit, do those adjustments. That changed back in 2007. I believe it's 2007, and now the books are required to be fully adjusted even before we come in. If we had to make the way reporting standards are now, if we had to make significant material adjustments, that would be noted as a significant deficiency in our report over the county's internal control over financial reporting. It shouldn't be if it takes the auditors to get the financial statements materially correct, and reliance on the auditors is no longer allowed. Disagreements with management. We had no disagreements with management in performing the audit. Again, if we had any disagreements, we would have to disclose that to you all. Management representations. We did require certain representations from management that they signed in a letter that we got before we issued the final report. And the last thing we have to communicate is management's consultations with other independent accountants, basically opinion chopping. As far as we're aware, management has not consulted other independent accountants for an opinion.
But you say you had those books in the car?
Yes, the bound copies.
Okay.
Well, Yes.
But I like to look at these things before I go through all this. What corrections does the county need to make? Usually at the end of that report, you have some opinions, and you've already said things appeared to be good, but are there any things that you'd like to see us improve?
There was no significant issues that we saw during this year's audit. There were a few little minor things as we go through. We'll work with management and say, have you thought about this? Can you do it this way? Have you considered doing it this way? Small things like that. But no, we didn't see any significant issues that needed to be reported on.
Last year, I think there were three items. Yeah. There were concerns that I needed to resolve.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, and I'd just like to say I would like to commend the county staff's effort on pulling this year's audit together with the turnover that the county had. Also, with the turnover, also still the county is still in the middle of implementing the new accounting system, which makes it very, very difficult. And I just would like to commend the county on being able to pull everything together for this year's audit. That's all I have, but I'd be glad to field any other questions. Thank you.
Okay. I'm here to discuss the final results of the BPSA Series 2012D that was priced on December 6th and closed on December 20th. And just in review, this is what we talked about for the last several months. The original amount being $67 million, two different options being available, all callable maturities or best callable maturities. And back in November when we talked, we decided that it was we were going to be able to do all callable maturities. And we had some estimates of present value savings of $6.3 million. We were actually able to get $7.65 million or 13.8%. And gross savings of $1.688 million in this fiscal year, $489,000 in 14, and approximately $385,000 through 2036. And the true interest cost of the actual is 2.72%. And just some graphs to kind of illustrate what happened. And this is kind of an apples to oranges, but the blue line is the coupon rates, and the 6.5% that everybody talked about is up there in the blue. And then the red line is the yields of the new bonds. So that's what people are going to actually earn on the new bonds that were sold. And this is coupons versus coupons, just some kind of odd-looking graph, but it shows you that overall, obviously, the coupon rates are much, much lower. And the only, the highest rate is 5% in those middle years. This is a lot of numbers, but I think if you go to the far right bottom corner, you'll see that gross savings over through 2036 is $10.6 million. And this is what was referred to earlier when we talked about being lucky. The yellow line being what happened after. And this is just a graph of the MMD, which is an index of the municipal market, and interest rates went up significantly following the sale, the week after the sale. If we had not sold then, and just 2 weeks later, we would have saved $2.5 million less. So it was a very good timing, a good thing for Fluvanna County. Any questions? Thank you. Thank you. But I feel very fortunate to have some very good professionals to work with, and to have your support and going out and doing that. So. All right.
Thank you very much. Outstanding.
Well, thank you.
The exact inverse of what we experienced against back in 2009, we took bonds out in the worst possible.
I know, it was like the worst possible and the best possible.
We
so.
The back end, so.
We knew the best.
Part of it,
we knew the best.
All right. Moving on to the consent agenda, we have the minutes of the December 19th meeting, FY13 budget supplement. The Sheriff's Department, FY13 budget transfer for emergency management services, capital reserve maintenance fund request, county capital reserve maintenance fund request for the schools. For example, needs to be pulled.
I don't have any problem with any of the rest. It's
have a something further, which is something that we move to consent agenda.
So moved to approve the so mentioned four items.
Is there a second?
Second.
This is made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. Allbrook. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0.
No, I just want to bring out the fact that, you know, we gave $14,900 the last time, and the time before that we gave $300,000, the time before that we gave $650,000. Now we're down to approximately $1,300, and they do have a budget of $34,800,000, and I think we're starting to nitpick a little bit, and I can't approve that.
Is there any further discussion?
I can't concur. As much as I say.
I'll make the motion then.
Well, I'm not doing it. You see my recommendation on there. I already talked to Mr. Winkler about it. In this case, I just didn't recommend approval on it either, but it's just because that's not. It doesn't meet the spirit and intent of what I thought you said when you put the rules in place for capital reserve maintenance funds.
Well, it can either die without a motion or we can move to kill it. It's your choice.
Is this okay?
I move to deny the guidance request from the school system of approximately $1,300.
Motion is made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. Allbrook. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor? All in favor to deny the request?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Opposed.
Aye.
That's an opposition. It's just that the chair votes to deny. The motion passes 3-2. Mrs. Booker, Mr. Chester,
okay, so this, the true fare was $1,364.70. I'm just saying that that was the fare that was denied.
Okay. Maybe since school superintendent's here and I'm here, any further guidance on what capital reserve maintenance fund request for?
Right. And, you know, I guess the larger point of this is it was expected to be from capital projects, not maintenance projects. I assume that was fairly clear, but perhaps we weren't as clear as we could have been. I mean,
do you have the guidelines here?
No. I thought we were drawing a policy on this.
Let me get the
blue table cloth versus white table cloth policy.
I think you insisted that they don't come before the board.
That's something wrong with that. What we need policy. If everything is coming forward.
Here's the policy. Now, the only difference on the actual one here is that they all come to board. But that's the language. By that language, you could theoretically fit almost anything in. But again, I thought I heard capital reserve maintenance funds. You know, there's kind of big rock stuff that were things that were like an unexpected failure. If that door in the courthouse broke today and the door cost $700 to replace the door, I wouldn't have expected so much to bring that here because it's a maintenance thing. So I'm not complaining because I have the same issue with stuff that I bring forward from county government. I'm just leaning more towards what I thought you said was kind of big rock stuff, fixed stuff, because it broke unexpectedly, it's not out of warranty, or it was out of warranty before, you know, things like that, but not more maintenance items.
What
right.
is this thing that's broken?
Does it affect
some
people? School superintendent. Yeah.
Can I speak?
Yes, ma'am, please.
Thank you. Would you go back to your paper, because I'll tell you what drove us to put this forward.
Awesome.
Yes, please. I'm sorry. The third bullet down, failure of equipment after warranty expiration but before expected life cycle. This is actually a blower for the wastewater treatment plant that serves the middle school and central elementary. Typically, it has a lifespan of 15 to 20 years is what we're told. This particular piece was an unexpected failure. No, I'll take it back. It was probably an expected failure, just, again, within a time span, but was the original piece in that wastewater treatment plant when it was installed. And that's, we are believing, based on their records, over 20 years. So this was a part that doesn't function anymore. So that answers that failure of equipment after warranty or but before expected life cycle. It was actually, it's been there a lot longer than probably it should have been. It was not part of the original CIP project to do the equalization tanks and the liner and all that, because we didn't know what it was expected. And I will tell you, just to cut to the chase, if we weren't in such a tight budget, there's no way we'd bring this to you. I can tell you that, because we would have some flexibility. Right now, even with the governor's proposed budget for next year and our most recent information based on the caboose bill, we stand to lose money this fiscal year from the state. So that's why we're bringing it. Not to annoy you, not because we're not following policy, because we have nowhere to go for these funds. And $1,500, $1,400 may not sound like a whole lot, but it is in the scheme of things. And yes, we have a $34 million budget, and we're working really hard to make that work for this year.
Where was the cutoff cutting you in this year's budget?
The caboose bill. Because of ADM and projections and enrollment, we're really stagnant. So we were crunching numbers actually this morning, and then we had our about a two and a half hour conference call right before our Christmas break to look at that. So you could conceivably talk about a little over $100,000. Last year, the caboose bill helped us.
Yeah.
This year,
not so much.
No. So just
that's all because of ADM.
Primarily, some ADM. We're going to do a presentation at the January 9th school board to give them all of the factors that influence that, Mr. Kenny. And we actually met with Mr. Nichols this morning just to talk about this kind of things. But that's clearly, just to paint the picture, it's definitely not a sob story. It's just the way it is. And so we're not doing it to annoy you. Yeah, absolutely. And yes, these are, excuse me, the money that's actually allocated for the small capital improvement could serve us even, you know, as we work toward, not just we, but as our economy improves, which I still believe it will in time, you know, I think you, if this continues, you'd see a different list of items because we'd be able to spend it differently. We just are looking at every single thing, and it behooves us to do that. And so that's why that was before you. Any other questions?
Any questions from the board?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. So existing policy is that, and that's what we follow. Essentially, I and the finance director put our recommendations on, after schools and put their recommendations on, to get it to you based on that kind of language. And so that's what you're seeing.
As an example, the $30,000 for the sheriff's office batteries should never be coming for you in a capital reserve maintenance fund request. That should be built into a day-to-day budget. It should be replaced on a cycle. It is never were. They will be. They're being built into the budget that way. Basis, those can be replaced because it's day-to-day operating expense. It's not a one-shot thing. We're over that limit now.
We're going to do accounts payable. That's tab B, accounts payable report.
Sure. One note for Barbara Sturgis. The finance folks have done a lot of hard work trying to make this report a little easier to follow. And so you'll notice on the report today that everything's line number. So I'm going to try to figure out who's on what page where. Just punch your line number up if you want, and we can go to it. The reports will be like that, so you'll know where you are in the report.
I know he's not here. I wanted to show that.
I will make sure that I let him know.
This will work.
And I have his book too.
Do we have a page? Is there like a starting letter? Do we have a book? Just out of honor. Is there a motion?
I move that the accounts payable be ratified here November 17, 2020, the amount of $1,936,325.13.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion is made by Mrs. Booker and seconded by Mr. Chester. Are there any questions about the accounts payable report?
That's very nice.
Hearing none. Call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 4-0. Mr. Weaver, present here. I'm sure he'll ask questions if he has any questions, but that tells you something. We don't have any questions about it. Mr. Weaver's the only one right here. God bless him. There's no other items of unfinished business, sir, but any items of new business?
This is a new year. Do we have any things we want to accomplish? I mean, is there some, you know, new year always brings, I'm not talking about resolutions.
Do we have the New Year's resolutions?
New Year's resolutions. I was just thinking about goals. What do we really want to get done this year? We want to get water. We want to get water done. So if we do, then I know staff's working, but we've got to plan out which way we're going, how we're going to get it done. But I need to, you know, staff's working on it, then what happens? When are they going to come back to us? What do we need to do next? What's next? So that we can have some timeline that we know that we're moving and we're making and we're accomplishing something.
I think we talked about water permits are going to be weeks away. Anyone who's said they bought the DOC permits is
6 weeks. So that's what they're
doing. What's happening? What's happening? Anything happened to talk to the PPEA? What's happening there?
I just thought I'd the update with Mr. Popovich today, but
oh, I said, yeah, you did say that. That's still on the table.
But they have not
responded, formally responded with new numbers to our request as we asked. And we've pushed back on that again, and I know we've got some communication last week from, when I talked to the spotless.
And then we also talked about community planning, looking at the properties. What we ought to do is nice crossroad when we get to that point. And does that pipeline, the OPOC, does it come through, where is it coming through? What right-of-way is it coming through? Do we have permission to go through the gas right-of-way or the VDOT or whatever?
I'm not sure that the DOC line would actually go through the gas right away. Just use the VDOT right away.
VDOT, right.
It's awkward than that.
Right.
Right.
And what about the James River Commit? What do we find if that expires in 8 years? What, are we starting something yet to make sure we don't lose that? You know, several.
All of the above. And that's part of the problem.
Honestly.
As excited as I am to pursue any one of those options, pursuing everything at one time with limited staff is just difficult.
But you're so good about lining those.
All those.
Yeah, but you're good about lining those things. That's all I'm asking.
Yeah, basically, that's all we're interested
in. I don't want to hear it's just been.
It's very bad right now.
I want to see it lined up, and I want to see it somewhere where I can check off some things, where I can see that we are moving. You know, I mean, I'm just I guess I'm an organizational list keeps me focused. I mean, I am focused, but I want to see something.
We'll put something together for if not next meeting,
sure.
Something the one after that.
Right, appreciate it. Because time's fine.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
it is.
Sure.
Part of what worries me is the back and forth boundaries of what we want to do or don't want to do. We pushed down the road pretty hard to try to work on these deals and try to pull them. They're complex and complicated. But then there's discussion today about, well, should we be really spending that money on the advanced side or not? And some of them will.
Well, you haven't asked that.
No, I think it's a wonderful question to ask. I'm not sure what the expected answer was. And the expected answer
is the answer you get out of every
economist. I don't know. I'm not sure what the questioner's expected answer was, so that I may know which kind of direction we're heading.
Our question is to see if you're going to have any money in investment debt for an infrastructure debt right now or beyond.
No, I'm not saying
you should legitimately ask some kind of
perfect question to ask.
Disregard the question, just keep going.
Okay.
That's kind of the way I took it, but
and we are working hard, and I know it's frustrating as heck, but we're a lot closer than we were a few months ago. We're getting there. I have not excluded any alternative option. None of them are off the table. We are certainly still continuing to set up a follow-on meeting with JRWA just continue to talk with Louise. Pretty interesting talking, but the Aqua Virginia proposal and the DOC option, and then the potential on the CIP, you'll get a big discussion this spring on the CIP about potential groundwater looks and groundwater views, will be a good time to decide whether or not we're going to take a comprehensive view over the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years and end up with all the terms there. But the Aqua and the DOC proposals, if there is political support for those, can be done sooner rather than later.
So you still have
no vote by Martin. Unreasonable?
I would say in conjunction with CIP, you can vote money one way or the other, even if we don't have an agreement, for instance, with DOC. On the Aqua one, I'm skeptical that you could have unless you want to vote on the Aqua proposal in its current form. If you want to vote on it in its current form, you can vote on, tomorrow, almost, to move forward formally. I certainly won't be recommending that, but on the DOC one, I just don't know until that permit turns over, because there's too many bluebirds that T's got to be crossed and the I's got to be dotted. It's not something I can rush to the process.
And we're also working on the levels.
Indeed, and some of those things we just have to talk, you know, talk in closed sessions for those times. And, staff and I are working very hard on a comprehensive look at all the different water solutions, not forgetting that there's been a lot of work done already, and a lot of research, a lot of review, and a lot of time put into it. But if you asked for a decision today, you wouldn't get a recommendation from me. Well, I understand, we got to move forward sooner or later. I have been complaining to you all about either let me free and let us go do this and work on this stuff, or just say stop so I can work on something else, because we can't do everything all the time. So I'm pleased that you've got some anxiousness and you're pushing a little bit. That's fine. Just I still can't give you a product today. It's not that far off. It's closer. I know it's not as good as you want, but that's what I got. I'll be glad to take more comments.
The word we want to avoid is prevarication.
Again, the most we can is not prevarication, much less apply it, so I don't think we'll have to worry about that.
I just want to point out that get off of this, Mr. Nichols, Mr. Chazer, Ms. Booker, and myself attended the Holiday Senior Luncheon a few weeks ago. And I just want to make a point that it was outstanding. It was well planned together. The turnout was somewhere in the 50-person range, which was larger than it's ever been. I think I had a promise it would be 101 people next year. 101. Next year, it's an eye-opener. It was an eye-opener. And a good time was had by all. Mr. Nichols had his brother the long time, and was doing the serving, which made it all that much better. But I just want to point out that it was lovely. Thank you very much. Parks and Rec is night and day in 2012. And I just picked up the 2013 Parks and Rec book, and everyone should grab it. It's concise. It's excellent. Every program in there is well printed out and the need for it. And I just want to point out that things are moving along, and that's one of the areas that I've seen a huge night and day change, not only in how it's being run, but participation is increased. I'm going to be a huge supporter in looking at this in the upcoming year on this program.
Any of our new business?
Yeah, go ahead and walk in the fire station.
It's
out of
the ground. It's
getting there,
isn't it?
It's getting there. I think so. It's coming
along. Right, okay. Second round of public comments. Go ahead again. Remember to keep your comments. State your name, keep your comments within 5 minutes, and address your concerns with the board. So, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Elizabeth Franklin, Kent Store.
Columbia District. I just want to pass along a citizen's observation about the Capital Reserve policy, or actually the fund itself. I watched the development, the creation of this fund, starting with sitting through the Planning Commission budget meetings when it was first created, and Mr. Coffey's presentation of that. And I must say that it is, I've watched the evolution of it and how it is described, what it is used for. And as a citizen, I find it very confusing and perhaps contradictory. I wish the policy were up there so I could refer to it, but I remember very well that there was some discussion of the use of the term capital in justifying the use of funds for capital projects. But I remember so well Mr. Coffey saying this is called the Capital Reserves Fund because there's a certain amount of depreciation based on the capital depreciation of our assets in the county. And I thought that's where the word capital came from. That's my recollection from those meetings. Also, in the narrative, and I still have copies of the original narrative for the justification of those funds, and I can't swear to it, but I think that those funds were to be used for expenses over $20,000. And I remember being confused about why some things were in the CIP that would seem to fall in the capital reserves, and the money seemed to be used in different ways. Now, as part of your packet, and you're the experts on this, I'm merely telling you what I'm seeing and what I recall from those meetings. But as there is a Mr. Dahl prepared a summary of the use of the capital reserves for FY13, and if it is true that those are to be used for expenses $20,000 and over, there are expenditures for far less than that. So I simply want to say, is it possible you could pull up that policy, Mr.? Okay. I will simply say that I remember squinting and reading several of those bullet points that referred to maintenance, that referred to repairs, that referred to, it seems the very things that the very thing that came before you today, and certainly Ms. Keller's, the bullet that she pointed to seemed exactly to describe what was being presented. So I can only say that I think it's very inconsistent and it seems confusing and very discretionary. It is your discretion, but it doesn't seem to make sense to me, and I've been part of watching this fund develop and how it was described and how what the original justification was. And if you could look back to that narrative where Mr. Coffey first explained it and it was in the CIP when it was brought forth from the Planning Commission to the Board of Supervisors, that narrative was for repairs and maintenance. So thank you.
Happy New Year. John Carrier from Overlook Circle. Sorry, I'm a little bit shorter. Just wanted to kind of come and speak. I had no intention of speaking today, but hearing the discussion of security in schools kind of hit home. December's been kind of a crazy month. A good friend of mine, the Hirschman's daughter or godmother, lost their son in the month of December in a good friend of mine, Greg Zajac's hometown, which you all may not have been familiar with prior to the month of December, but that hometown is Newtown, Connecticut, where 26 lives were lost. And for those of you that may not have read this particular Flavanna Review article back following the Virginia Tech massacre, I did write a letter to the editor that addressed specific concerns related to school security here in Flavanna County. And specifically pointed out that you never know whose hometown such an issue will strike. And what has brought my attention again here today is that what was once a student bringing violence on a student no longer exists. We're now discussing adults bringing these issues into the schools, and we'd like to address again the school security and have intention also to have this conversation with the school board as well. Being that I'm sure that there will be some consideration for funds that should need to be considered to improve school security, I do not believe that the Fluvanna County School security systems or perhaps even policy addresses the future of where the violence could come and could occur. And I am the son of the middle school and high school school psychologist, and during her education I was in middle school slash high school, and our dinner conversations were slightly different from many others, where as I was heavily involved in wanting to become somebody involved in public safety, I had a strong interest in the psychological differences of others, and have taken also an interest in these, in how public safety responds. Simply having one resource officer available to our schools may not be enough for what our students and most valuable citizens may be. And this, just given the general age of the school buildings that exist now and the lack of upgrades in furnishings to meet security obligations is not there. So I requested the board that we have some level of discussion between the Board of Supervisors and the school board, as well as community and public members, to find a way to improve our school security. You can get 12 feet or more into Central Elementary unchallenged just based on location of offices and where people sit. And a lot of damage can be done in that 12 feet. We know and will continue to learn from the events of Sandy Hook exactly what worked and what failed in that attack. And we know that there was an alert system. They had a good system in place, and yet violence found its way through. We do need to improve this. This no longer is going to be somebody else's problem. The fact of the matter is that Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, and all the other situations of violence throughout our country, I'm sure that Sandy Hook said, well, Columbine will never happen here. For me, I can't go into a public building without noticing the routes of egress, where I sit in relation to open doors, where I am in relation to where I can hide my children, where I can put them into safety. And we cannot continue as a community that wants to value our citizens and value our children and not take into consideration how we're going to protect those children. Do either of you know, or any of you know, what the policy reads on how our teachers and school officials respond in the event of an active shooter situation? We may not know, but these things have to be worked upon, and I think that it's an appropriate time, given the new year, to work together with the school board and to find ways to improve our school safety. It's really that important. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anyone else
wishing
to address the board? So we close. We're going to have a public comment. We don't have any item for close the meeting, so we'll go ahead and return to the recess and we'll reconvene at 6 o'clock. We'll go ahead and enter into a work session with the Commissioner of Revenue and the Treasurer to discuss updates. So go ahead and recess the table and close the
meeting.
Good.
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 What's all right?
Is
that good?
It's all good.
Okay, first up.
So we've got two presentations and then question and answer with the Commissioner of Revenue and the Treasurer. You can do an either or, which you like, which is short. They're both awesome. Okay, we'll go with Mr. Sheridan first. Since he's on top.
All right, I want you to prepare.
Oh, no, I'm prepared. I'm prepared. Getting a little guidance from the finance director. She's coaching me there. We were talking public utilities. Pardon me, sir.
That's the forward and back.
Gotcha. Okay, obviously the slides are what we talked to before, but Mr. Nichols and I thought, or primarily me, Mr. Kenny is with us. The slides are the slides that really are oriented toward this coming year. And thank you all for letting me to have a chance to go over them with you again. And so I will not belabor them, frankly, because you've seen them, and it may be a little bit more on your radar now that we're getting a little closer to the coming year. The reassessment, we know that the meetings, you know, the reassessment meetings were done, completed, so it's no big deal. This is old news. But it does bear to once again reflect that the difference, the delta in what we were at and what we are at as of yesterday, January 1st, is 25.9 down. Not as bad as it had been anticipated, but not great, but over 6 years, not too bad.
Pretty good. So that's the official number?
Yes, sir. That's the official number. It will be amended slightly as the Board of Equalization does its work. And that number reflects the work of the assessors, you know, the when they did their stuff, the 435 meetings they had. They changed some, 208. They did not change others. And I can tell you of the 227 that did not get changed, a number of them plan to go back and talk to Board of Equalization. So will the 25.9 change? Yes, I think it certainly will change, but not much.
It won't be higher than after 26, will it? It won't be higher.
It potentially, well, I don't think so. That's correct, Mr. Dornbach. It could. The Board of Equalization has the authority to go up or down. And if you, and since we've got the time to talk just a little bit, as you know, some of the citizens are upset that it went down more than they wanted it to go down. We've had one of the developers come in and talk to you all about that. And at the end of the day, when they finish their work in, I suspect, about April, I don't think it'll change more than a decimal because, again, they're working off of this $2.6 billion tax base. So if they come in and change something by a couple of million dollars, again, on a 2.6, it's a fraction of a decimal. So I think my guidance to the board would be that the 25.9 is the hard number we use to set the equalization rate whenever y'all get to that point that's the taxable value we'll be using. Board of Equalization will be going on the ground on January 17th. Thank y'all for acting on that, you know, as expeditiously as you did. So.
Just a note, I'm not sure if we talked about this before, I don't know if Mr. Sheridan and I talked, but the little building that's across from the treasurer's office, that two-story little building, that's being just cleaned up and moved stuff in and put the phone in. And Mr. Cavan's working on the IT access, because that way we'll have a second place on the side of the Morris Room. The old place they can call home while the coffee's table in there, and the table desk and chair for Joanne Wall.
I think we can get that
right there. And so it'll be a good place you can use as a swing space for those kinds of functions. And we'll need to do some other renovations long term because of asbestos mitigation and tiles and things. But in the interim, it's a good place to use. And we need to treasurer's office.
What space is there?
It's two floors, and it's about what, 18 by 18 or 15 by
15? Right. Howard Evergreen's office.
From five different companies, and there are still some here that once in a while use it for things, but it's maybe 18 by 18, you know, or two different floors.
It really will free up also the having to always commit the Morris Room or the small conference room. And it's very one of the very nice things about it, it won't impact parking down in this area, and it doesn't impact the use of the copy machine. And frankly, it gives them access to both Ms. Linder and I and my office so we can help them as they meet resources. It's right out the door, 50 feet. It's a really good use of the building, provided we can get the things done that need to be done.
Some signage out there.
Yeah. We'll have a
unidentified map on the website, so when they make the appointment, it's called to show them that, because we'll have planning just do like an overhead view to show it, but then we'll have some signs on the side of the hill there, not that far.
Yeah, new county administrator is real big on good signs.
So we're
working on them. Anyway, the only thing that's really important on this, I would tell you, is this number, and that's, pardon me, wrong button, is the 25.9. That 25.9 is the hard number I think you need to work with. 26 is probably a good solid number. Board of Equalization, I really don't think they'll meet as with as many people this time as they did 6 years ago. They met for about 5 months last time. They met for the full year. That's what their charter is, but effectively they're done in about the five. I think these, you know.
More time, Mel, to work on this time. You remember when we did it, we didn't give them any time.
Yes, sir. We in fact, we had to get an
extension.
And we had to get an extension, you know. We didn't get, we weren't ready on January 1st. And that's happened for the last two, in 07 and in 05. But different scenario this time around.
But they got to pay for it.
Well, they should not have, you know. If they did, that would be wrong. That was my point, Ms. Booker. I think they'll be done. They actually took 5 months in 07 because they met with over 500 citizens. And they do, unlike the, I don't mean to belabor it, but it, you know, it's good working information so you know, because the citizens will be asking y'all. Unlike the board of, the assessor hearings where you get about 15 minutes, they don't go back out and look at your property. They've met, you know, they've been to your property. Board of Equalization, well, you know, say Mr. Weaver comes in, they'll hear Mr. Weaver's concern. And they may assign one of their members to go out another day and then come look at it and say, you know, Mr. Weaver is right or wrong, or he did. And then that person will come back and brief the other members, and they make a final decision. At the end of how long they meet will be driven by, to formally answer your question, they meet for a full year, December 31 of 2013. How long they actually will need to come in for appointments depends on how many people call and set up an appointment. And my bet is it's going to be less than it was in 07. I'm guessing 200 or 300 max. So y'all know the kind of the fervor about the reassessment, you know, kind of petered out after about, you know, when that number came in at 25.9 instead of 48 or 48.9 or 50. So to put a point on it, I'm hopeful they'll be able to finish their work by certainly the first part of April, maybe March. They get 150 people come in, 2-3 months max. Okay, I'll try to move on then. Just some recommendations. Y'all know this, it's old news. I think we ought to try to do it certainly on a 3-year cycle. Two would be my recommendation, like a number of our neighbors do. It would avoid the large swings. Wasn't as large as it might have otherwise been. And I'm very glad for that. I thought you might like to have some numbers just real quickly again. If it were brought in-house, that's an estimate of about $120,000 a year. And that's with two people. That would be addition to my office, county administrator's office, any office y'all want to put them in. I think it could be done with two people and some existing staff help. It's usually been with more than that in other counties. I think Fluvanna could do it with two. But you can't hire two people for, and that might be a conservative number, the 120. And Steve and I talked about it. For some reason, I thought 120 was, that might be on the shallow side. It may be closer to about 140 because you're going to have to spend 55 and 40 or 45. That's, call it, 95 plus benefits plus, you know, operation. 150 is probably a better number. 140 is conservative. If you brought them in-house.
When should we be making that decision? Won't be until after 2014.
You need to be making a decision now on what cycle you want.
Yeah.
So we can start planning for that budget before. I mean, even if it's 3 years, you really need to know that now so you can start building it in. But if you're going to do it on a 2-year cycle, which would be recommended, if you decide now or next, you know, this spring, on what the cycle is going to be, then we can start planning for that, start looking at all alternatives and options out there, and
It takes 9 months for them to do their work, basically. They started in about November, and they finished pretty close to November. So 9 to 12 months for them to do a full, a third party. Now, if you want to hire people, I'd say they ought to be on board. I would tell you 6 months before they actually started doing that work. So a ballpark from, like, we just had an effective date of yesterday. If we had hired people and done it in-house, we should have hired them about certainly 14 months ago to give them on board and have them have the time to do their work.
So if you want 2 years, we're looking at
it. It would be about...
July of this year.
Do you have to do the assessments in next calendar year? Calendar year 2014.
It would be 15. You know, you would have we just had it effective January 1 of 2013. On a 2 year cycle, it'd be January 1 of 2015.
But you have to do the assessments in calendar
in 14. That's correct.
That so hired them at the end of 13. Yeah. The end of 13.
Now this is a little different. Now, I did not know this was an option. I talked to Blue Ridge because they were here and were easy to talk to, just to get a feel. So that you have a complete picture, find the right pointer here. This is a second option. If we went back to a third party, outsourced it again, there we go. They do, when they did the full, you know, we spent a little less than that actually, but we got a really good deal this time around. If they were to come back and do another one on a 2 year turnaround, their opinion was that they would not have to visit every property again. They would visit every new property, and so if you had built something, they'd certainly visit that, and they would pick, you know, certain properties, spot check, thank you, I couldn't think of the right term, Don. They'd spot check, but not revisit, and so instead of having the price of about $13 was the running average, they did it for $10.70 because we worked them pretty hard. I don't think we'll get that rate again, but on a relook at the 2 year timeline, they could do it for $6.50 a parcel, $6.50 to $7 per parcel. Keeping in mind, we had a little over 15,600 parcels. So that economically is a better deal than doing it in house, although I don't know if you get quite the same amount of service.
Well, I think
other than to say this. If we outsourced it on a 2 year cycle, they do a full one, and then 2 years later they do the partial, that's not a partial, it's a full, but an abbreviated might be a better term, and catching all the new parcels, spot checking the old ones, and then in the 4 year point, they pick the full one back up again. The significant difference is we have the availability of the assessor and that person's staff of one more available to the citizens year-round. If you had a concern, you can't get Blue Ridge to come back out and visit your property. If they worked for, you could make an appointment with the local assessor, and that's the advantage, I think. That's probably the significant advantage. There are others, but that's the significant one. So if somebody comes in and says, I want to talk to who looked at my land, who makes this decision, they can't do that until we have Blue Ridge or whomever come back in and couple of 3 year timeline. I guess we about beat that one to death. I threw this on here for not to complicate you, but it's the public utilities that we have on the left side of the page, and I know it's a lot of numbers. I don't mean it to gee whiz you, but all of those, everybody thinks of Tenasco as our utility. Well, we got a lot more than just Tenasco. That's the biggest one. Tenasco, sits, I'm having to do some time. There we go. Right here. And if you look across, basically, what it means is that for 2012, we got $1.5 million, almost $1.6 from Tenasco. And the other utilities associated with everything from Virginia Power, which is down here, Virginia Power, it got $681,000. It's an old coal plant, but it's still giving pretty good tax revenue.
If they go to gas, how would that affect the taxes?
I don't know. What happens here? These numbers are nothing. These are. I don't know that it'll affect it appreciably because it may increase the revenue we get. I'll tell you why. all these numbers that we receive, and it just basically says, they break public utilities down like we do our household. They have some personal property, cars and trucks, not a lot, but if they are, they're at a different rate, you know, they're different person. And then everything, you know, that's at the real estate rate, SCC tells us what their property is worth. And they do that annually. And this is available to y'all anytime you want it. I've sent it down from time to time. Not just for 2012, we went back and put it together for all the years. But the SCC will tell us, and anytime they make improvements to utilities, they will value those improvements into what the annual value is. So if they convert to natural gas, my opinion is that that's going to increase their value because it's now operating at a more efficient, and with a cleaner fuel. They haven't done any improvements to any of our telecommunications. When we put up a cell tower, if it's a cell tower, it goes on a list, and they pay us the associated taxes. So in converting that, if that happens, I would predict it goes up. So the only thing I wanted you to notice is down to bottom right. Shucks, where's the red dot? I need something with a sight on it. That $3 million is what we got for all of our utilities for 2012. That's a hard number. That's not, an estimate. That's exactly what we got. Now, this is what's unique about that number. That is based on 100% of the value of the public utilities. We all know that our citizens have been, running higher than 100%. So as we make that 25.9% change in our rate, I'll just say for example, if the equalization rate is 75, from 59.81 to 75, 26% increase, the citizen average check would be for the same exact figure. But the utilities will go up 26%. Mr. Weaver's got the idea. Y'all with me? Because, see, they haven't been paying at 125% of value, 118. They've been paying only at 100 because they have really good lobbyists. And the lobbyists worked out some time ago that once the locality's ratio is at 100% or above, utilities only pay at 100%. So that really is important to us. And trust me, I've already been contacted by the local representative, not the full-time manager, but the local citizen's representative for Tenasco about how that's going to impact them. And the news is the news. If the rate goes up to reflect the decrease in their value, it's going to impact their utilities pretty significantly because it's going to be a true increase to them. It's exactly the same for land use, too, and I'll get to that in just a minute. But I think I hit the turn it off button. I'm sorry, Steve, I got it. So if you're with me, and that's what Ms. Horlack and I were talking about, that $3 million figure, $3,002,184.95, will be impacted by what the board needs to do with the tax rate.
Could be $750,000.
Yeah, that happens to be, I could be very close to that. Might be less, might be more, but I know y'all will work that out in about 4 months. But it impacts them as a hard value, not because their values aren't. Now, I will tell you this. I anticipate from talking to Mr. Hickey, when they turned their numbers in at the 25.9% reduction, we were at about 98% of what the Department of Taxation thought. They try to come within 3% plus or minus. I'd like to have been at 100% our values, so we were at 100%. So worst case, we come in at, say, 97%. And what that means, you all make an adjustment to the rate. Let's say it's 75 cents just for conversation. And that would mean they would go up $750,000. But only 97% of that, because if it's below 100, they take advantage. We're all consistent on that. But that's going to help your revenue picture this year.
And maybe tax increase this year.
That's why y'all get paid all the big bucks.
Back to the taxpayers this year.
That might be what y'all elect to do. I certainly, believe they'll do the right thing. Public utilities, give you a ballpark. What happened in FY12? It went down. There's a reason for that. Traditionally, it goes up. I could give you FY9. I just only pulled up three. Went up 300,000 from 9 to 10. You know, went up 118 from 10 to 11. It went down last year, and it's specifically because, you may remember I covered this, but you had a lot on your mind. The public utilities were able to lobby through General Assembly last year that any monies that had been spent previously on emissions controls equipment, scrubbers primarily, like for the coal plants and all, they could, the value of that equipment, those improvements, would be tax exempt. It didn't happen until July of 2012, but they got to take advantage of any improvements they'd made in the previous, I think, about 15 years. So that's why, and I knew that was coming. I'd shared that with the county administrator. We were happy it only impacted $71,000. That was a one-time anomaly, so that what I anticipate is, again, for this coming year, it affected Tenasca and it affected Virginia Power, but $3,002,000 will go up whatever the true value is that y'all apply in the equalization rate, plus or minus. Land use, just very quickly. Those are the acres that are in land use. They're broken down into those two categories. If we didn't have any of those acres in land use, the $2.3 million is what we defer. That's what we don't collect. That really is not the complete picture. It is, and it isn't. That's why you got to have the other shoes got to drop, or the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey might have said. Keep in mind, we still have an ag forestal. If the board, because it thought it was the right thing to do, eliminated land use completely, you'd think $2.3 million would come back to you. That'd be the additional taxes we'd pay if we were in land use. Remember, we have ag forestal, and in ag forestal, if we don't have a land use program, the properties that are in the ag forestal districts then are afforded the reduced tax rate. So to truly capture all that revenue back, so that you understand how it works, you'd have to have both programs be eliminated. And even there's one small little nuance of the conservation easements, and folks that are in conservation easements get the land use rate also. And that can't be reversed, and the actions of this board can't reverse any of that. So again, that's what it cost us to have a land use program, $2.3 million. Just some thoughts I had, same tax revenue. We know this, I won't belabor it. If you're on a 100-acre parcel and you got a house and the first 2 acres not in land, you should pay exactly the same dollar as somebody that's living on 2 acres with the same house. No tax deferment there, just the acres that are unimproved. This is one thing that some people tend to forget. And a lot of our land use people are generational families. They're not necessarily wealthy, you know, big timber companies. They may have had it handed down 2, 3, or 4 generations, some even more. They'll pay their taxes whatever we set the rate at. It'll hurt, but they'll pay it. But the first time they get that letter in the mail that says, will you sell, they're going to start thinking about it a lot more seriously than and the land use rates that we have. They're going to be adjusted, but I'm just tossing that out for what it's worth. A lot of people think everybody in land use is a large timber, you know, person, a large timber company, and that's not the case. Again, just some thoughts on it. We still sit, and I submit to you one day they'll come back and start asking those landowners to sell their property. Yeah, I bet you Mr. Weaver got the land. I bet you Ms. Booker got them. Anybody had probably 50 acres or more in the 05, 03, 04, 06, got a letter a week asking them to sell their land, you know, if they would consider it. It just was that many developers. Yes, I can. Y'all know that there's also a third component to, it's a very small component to land use. It's called an open space contract, and that is a little different vehicle. If you have 10 acres or more, back up, to be in land use, you have to either be an agricultural application or forestal. You know, you can't just have fallow land and be in the program.
But if you have 10 acres or more, a part of the land use program is an open space contract arrangement. And we have not many. We have probably a 12, something like that, in the county. And that's where this board goes in, enters into a contract with the landowner. Let's say Steve Nichols wanted to put 15 acres in the open space contract, but he doesn't have any, you know, cows or chickens or whatever. He doesn't make hay. Open space, he actually has a contract that you'll see one coming through. Dr. Babbitt, Sam Babbitt's going to renew his, where the landowner commits to not developing the property for a period of time. It's generally 4 to 10 years in that ballpark, 4, 6, 8, or 10. And they submit the contract to the board and ask the board to agree to it. So it's two parties, the landowner and this board, and generally the county administrator acts on behalf of the board once the board approves it. And you have a number of these out there. If you haven't individually seen one, it's because they don't come up very often. But the board, if it agrees to it, the contract's executed, and the landowner gets the reduced land rate, the land use rate, for the period of the contract. If the landowner reneged on it and went out and subdivided it or built a house on it, then same thing would apply, rollback penalty, et cetera. So you'll see one very soon, probably in the 16th, for Dr. Babbitt. It's not new, it's just it's not many. There are really a few, just a few of them, but you'll see them occasionally, and it's an agreement that gives them the rate, the reduced rate, and their return is that they don't develop the property. And then lastly, land use. Land use is, these are the rates that apply per acre. That's what it really boils down to. So if you're in Fluvanna County, it's $150 for an acre of land. That's the taxable value assigned. That happens to be more than what the state recommends, but not as much as their neighbors. For Forestall, it's $275. Those can only be adjusted during years of reassessment. During years of reassessment, the commissioner has a responsibility to assign new values. If it's not a reassessment year, they're fixed. They can't be touched. Cumberland, you can see, is at $500 and $500. Powhatan, $450, $450. Buckingham does not have land use. Goochland, the $280 and the $613, they happen to be the SLEAC. That's the state committee that recommends values. Albemarle, these are the what Albemarle's are, $146, $254. Louisa goes by the state recommended averages, and they're complicated. Fluvanna is, just so you know, is everything from $10 for agriculture, for open land, and the worst class of land, $10 per acre, all the way up to a whopping $100 an acre. And forest is $177 up to, and it's good, it's poor, you know, average and excellent, forestal. Those are the three categories. We used to be in the business of trying to figure out how many acres you had of each of the eight categories of land. It was guesswork at best, and one of my deputies was going blind, trying to read a 1950 USGS map with dots and acreages. I asked the Department of Taxation if we could adopt a policy of having one standard for each acreage of agriculture, each type, and just have an, and they said yes. They have formally approved that, as they have for a lot of counties, because there's just not any tools that will really give you much help on trying to decide if it's class 1 through 8. Right. I mean, the soil hadn't changed much, but I got to tell you, it was terrible. The process, the methodology was, we just got almost no return for the effort we put into it. Albemarle still does it because they have an individual whose sole responsibility is land use program to implement, and they still do that.
Yeah, why don't you demo? What you increase it this year will be this coming year on the ag and forestry
from what? Well, as a starting point, and we haven't, that's not been finalized, Mr. Weaver, but what Mr. Weaver's saying is I went ahead and went to 300 on agriculture and 500 on forestal as a starting point. I have to tell the folks in land use, and that is a high water mark, I can tell you. I personally would not, will not go above that. I may try to, I want to see what SLEAC's going to do to me for 13, what their recommendations are. And I'll tell you why. That's a high water mark. It may be a little less because it's a true increase on the people in the land use program too, like it is the public utilities. And when I say true increase, if I go to 300, for example, on agriculture, that's 150 to 300. That's 100% increase. Then if we have a equalization rate that takes us up to 75, if that happens to be what it is, then that's another 26% on top of the 100% increase from 150 to 300. And that's why I have to put something on the land use forms that I send out as in September. So they went out three months ago to be certified for this coming year, 2013. So I can revisit that, and I'll tell you when I can revisit it too, right up until the day that y'all give us the formal tax rates, because it's not hard copy until we do the land book. Once we put the rates into our software that then produce the land book, which produces the billings, then it's finalized.
If you leave those rates where you anticipate on increasing them to, how much additional revenue would that account? But you know all the acres in there.
I had that number off the top of my head, Don, and I think it's about $50,000, but I need to go back. I have it on my computer at my office.
Yeah, actually,
and frankly, I could have told you on November 7th, but I don't want to guess at it. We just simply worked it. I'm sorry. I believe I will send that to Mr. Nichols tomorrow, who will, I'll ask if we'll forward it to you. Oh, I can email you all. No, what Mr. Weaver asked me, if I understood it correctly, if we go to 300 and 500, what would be the additional revenue to the county? And it's just straight math. It's not guesswork. And I have that number on my PC, and I just don't remember it right off the top of my head.
The base, 2.3 million now.
Yeah.
For 150 and 275.
And that's...
Why would it only go by $50?
I want to...
Yeah, that's what happens.
No, it doesn't pay 2.3. That's what's deferred. Remember now, that's what the citizens don't pay, okay? If we didn't have land use, they would be paying 2.3 million more. That's not what we collect from the acreages that are in land use. That's what we don't collect. Yeah, well, that's true. Sometimes it's, well, we have that. It's in the land book. I mean, the land use book. It's very simple to...
So the 150 and the 275 is the per acre
value that is assigned to any acres. For example, if I have 20 acres of woods forest in the land use program, and it happened to be assessed at $2,000 an acre, I don't pay taxes on $2,000 per acre. I pay taxes on $275 per acre. That's the reduced rate. Now, the commitment I as a landowner have is I'm not going to develop it or subdivide it. If I do either, then I have to pay a rollback tax on it. And that's, it's current plus five. And that's right, Mr. Weaver. So if I take it out during 2013, I give 3 acres to one of my sons. Not only has the 3 acres come out, but because it now dropped below 20 is a magic number for forest, all 20 come out of land use. So I have to pay for the full value in 2013 this year, plus the previous 5 years. What I do is simply notify the treasurer's office, and she helps make sure that we have the accurate tax. And we go back to the actual taxable rate for that year, for 12, 11, 10, 9, and 8, and apply, you know, the... so that we get a complete, you know, picture of the revenue that's collected, and you get a bill for the land use. That's the penalty, in effect, that you pay if you take land out of land use. If I change that number from 275 to 500, then they're going to pay effectively 90% more. And then if the rate goes from 59 to 70, I'll just pick a number. And that's, say that's 20% increase. They pay 90% because of rate change and 20% because of the the taxable rate change, so it'd be 110, 115% increase on the taxes. True taxable increase of 115, 120.
What's so, the average value for ag land and forest land in the county? Real value?
It depends on the acreage that's involved, but if it's under 50 acres, it's probably in the neighborhood today of around $1,800 to $2,000 per acre. That's what the new assessments are coming in.
Under
50. The larger the tract, you get a slight reduction. If it's under 50 acres, I'll say it's 2,000. If it's 50 to 100, it may be 1,800. If you have a 200-acre parcel at 201 or larger, it may be 1,500 per acre. They stair-step the rate per acre down, slight decrease if you, for the bigger acres. And that's been consistent ever since I've been the commissioner. If you have under, and we recognize anything at 10 acres or more as a large acreage parcel, as opposed to if you have 9.9, it's not a large acreage parcel. What that means, and that's an important number to you, I've covered this before, but if you have a 10-acre parcel that doesn't have a house on it, then you're not assigned a 2-acre house site value. You are taxed on the straight 10 acres, whatever the value is. If it's 9.9, first 2 acres has a taxable value of, say, $35,000 now for that first 2 acres, and then maybe $2,000 per acre for the remaining seven. Sorry it's complicating. I know it's a long day, but maybe it's the opportunity to ask some of these, you know, particular questions.
What's the value on the forest?
It's $275 right now.
No, I mean the actual value.
They don't delineate between forest and open land. Yeah, if you have a 100-acre piece and it's the same value associated, whether it's all open or all forested or a combination, they don't delineate. We do when it becomes part of the land use program. What I would suggest to you is I'm thinking maybe a 300 and 500 were the high water mark, but I'm thinking along, and I have it broken down. Got a chart. If we make it 200 and 400, here's how much money revenue we get. If we make it 250 and 450, here's the revenue we would get. And I did the revenue based on the 59.81. I don't have that crystal ball. I know what it'll be in April. That's it for my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any additional questions you might have. Thank you. Okay. If you want anything like a public utility, report, it's very easy to send. It's already done. All I got to do is click, point and click, and it's in your mailbox. Lickety split. The 2012 or any time prior to that, 2000 back to 2004. Oh, you're certainly welcome. Thank you. And let's see, Linda.
That one advances the slide. That one backs it up.
Thank you.
You got it.
Yeah, I'm going to take that. And this, there's a little red dot.
I don't need a little red dot. Good evening.
Good evening.
Is everybody awake?
No.
Yeah. Okay, good.
What that man? Bruce.
Sit back.
Start a football game.
You know this.
Duh. Are you ready? While Steve, yeah, I know he did, didn't he? While Steve's trying to get this to fit on the page, I'm assuming. But anyway, does everybody have the handout? Okay, we're going to start with personal property, and basically, it's 2007, 2008, 9, 10, 11, and 12. The information is there. Collection rates are there. So basically, it's just kind of cut and dry. What we collected is what we collected, and what we billed is what we billed, and abatements and.
What did we collect?
Which one do you want?
Well, which one do you want to give us?
Well, let's take 2012 because okay. 2012 actually with a 90% collection rate, I'm impressed because I'm going to tell you before we ran these numbers, we didn't think that. I mean, We really didn't.
So that means we have 10% more to collect in the
future.
Next year.
In the future, yeah.
The average has been running 95% over the last 6 years.
Yeah.
95% when it's old, if you look at like real property, I mean, in subsequent years, those rates will go higher because it gets applied.
Applied, yes, yes.
Yeah. So it's just like any collection. Maybe 89% today, but 6 months from now, maybe 92%.
Right.
Maybe 90, the farther you go down,
the
shorter the
stuff. So how do we know when it's we get a 3% more collection in months down?
Because we can give you another report.
You give us a report.
Yes. If you want a report quarterly, if you want it, I don't know how you would like it. You tell me, and we'll give it to you. But what you're seeing in 2012 and 2011, now 2012 we have not put on our DMV stops, which is where we connect with DMV, we put their vehicle, their social, everything out there. When they go to renew their tags on their vehicles, they are not allowed to do that till they pay us. So they have not been put on because this is based as of December 31st, okay? So we're in a new year now. And basically, we have to send out a letter to the people that we're putting it on to notify them that the DMV hold is going on. And we usually give them about 15 to 20 days to get it paid before we put that stop on. Once we put the stop on, it costs them $40 more.
Does that say that in the notice?
Yes, it does. It tells them that they will be adding, we'll be adding an additional $40 plus, you know, interest is calculated every month, so that all changes. So basically we send them a demand letter. And then once we send our information down to DMV, DMV sends them out a little notice that says, hey, you owe Fluvanna taxes. You got to take care of that before you can. So it's really a double cycle once we get all the information. Now, putting those on, it does take us a little while because if there's any discrepancy with DMV and our information, they kick them out in what's called an errors report. We go back, correct all of our errors, and resubmit.
You do all this, what do you do this by hand?
By computer. It's all done on our computers. But we do get an errors report, which we, you know, it might be missing. It's an incorrect VIN number. You know, you've keyed in a wrong one on a VIN number, which is very difficult to key in, I'm going to tell you. It's a long number.
We collect 90%. But what did we collect in the last 12 months that hadn't been collected that had not been there by either? In other words...
Yeah, this is the 2012 is your June and December collections.
Mm-hmm. But I want to know what back taxes you collected in that period. Tell me a little bit.
In 2012?
Yes.
From 2011.
You see where I'm going with?
Yeah, I see where you're going.
How do you keep, that's what my question was too. How do you keep up with, you got 2011.
We run 2011 for everything that's been collected.
So that's 6%. How much of that 6%?
So I guess, Gloria, we would have to run to give them that, which we can get you, but we have to run another report.
Right.
And if I'd have known you wanted it, we could have.
I didn't know.
And we can do that, Don.
First time.
Can I email?
That's important because right. I already collected 90%.
Right.
I want to know what.
Well, this is 90% of 2012.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, now how much?
But is our pastor going to make up?
The way to answer it is to, on here, if this were a snapshot in time, what's the same snapshot look like a month ago? Same snapshot.
Right.
Because that 95% wasn't 95%.
No.
6 months ago or 10 months ago or 12 months ago, maybe 94.5%.
Yeah. So that's what you're looking for is, okay, so all we have to do is go back and run that report. I mean, we do have a process where we can run it by date and year. Okay. So, any questions on that?
No.
All right, Steve, are we ready for...
My question. It's unlikely that the 2012 number is going to go above
About 95%.
95%, yes. That's about where you're going to see it.
Why can't we get above 95% if real estate always gets above 95% long-term?
Personal property is a little more complicated than real estate. Personal property, you have your people moving out of the state. In order for me to go after them once they move out of the state, I have to go through the governor of Virginia, through the Secretary of the Commonwealth. That's the only way that I can get a proceeding to go after somebody for a personal property bill. You know, they have to owe us a lot of money to go through that process, and it's not just a simple little process.
What's the most money, generally, though, that you see on a case like that?
On a case like that, that they move out?
Uh-huh.
It's probably less than $500.
So what's the total? What's the total loss?
About $500. Yeah.
$400,000 a year.
Well, then, which one are you looking at?
Many in 1 year?
No.
Not just for one person, but if you look at 2007, the difference between billed amount of payments is $400,000. The next year, the difference is $400,000. The next year, the difference is $400,000, $380,000.
Okay, now if you're looking at 2007, the amount that is owed us is $89,000. Now, we have DMV holds on these. You know, there's DMV holds.
Oh, what's the ABA?
That's the abatements. That's what the Commissioner of Revenue took off because they were not here.
Okay. So the
inventory.
Is the difference between these two?
See, I'm looking at inventory. That is actually what we're showing as being outstanding due Fluvanna County for 2007.
Blue yes. Minus green equals the sum of these two things down here. The
right. Right.
Inventory.
Yes. That's our inventory. So that's what our general ledger on our computer system is showing.
Except 300 was written off.
Yes.
So in 5 years, we have a total of...
$400,000 plus another $300,000.
Yeah. I mean, we put everything we can out there.
Right.
Why is it worth going after?
But if they only owe us $500 for a year, I mean, we can do it if that's what the board wants us to spend their time on.
Why can't we turn to a collection agency that we don't pay, they get a percentage?
Isn't there things that happen like someone, let's say you move to Texas,
mm-hmm.
and you transfer your registration,
right.
and you put your plates up in your barn, you don't turn them in.
Right.
Gee, did that happen to you? And the state that I moved from, I owed. They call it excise tax, but I owed it for the years it was sitting in my barn.
How did they catch up with you?
When I moved back to the state.
Oh, okay, so see, that's, yeah.
And went to transfer my license, they said, you owe me like
$6,000. I'm not sure how to do it, but I mean, in most businesses, you've got a collection. You've got several phases of collection. Kind of the final phase of collections is when you turn the whole account over to somebody and all you get is 40% or 60% of what?
That's what
you
don't pay for,
Don.
Can that be done?
Sure. I mean, you're
something's better than
you pay them a fee. To do it, yes. They get a percentage. Yes.
They get a percentage. You don't
mm-hmm.
get a fee.
No. They get a percentage of what they collect.
But you get, if we got 60% of $104,000,
even if we got... That's just the point I made. A lot of people make honest mistakes that they don't even know they made.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
it catches up to you.
They fail.
It's better to get caught in a year than it is 5 years down the road.
It's better to get something rather than nothing.
Nothing. I mean, and there's plenty of them out here that want to do this.
And you're better off.
I'd rather somebody catch me my first year, catch me 5, 6 years
mm-hmm.
down
the road. Right. Because that, the scenario I just gave you happened.
And I know that we have an instance where the person dies. There is no estate because, you know, there's, so that's, yeah. But, I mean, I'll be glad to look them up. And, of course, Mr. Payne's going to have to read over any contract that we have with anybody in the collection.
It's really common.
Okay.
And I'm not sure common treasure belt.
Well, no, but I know there's some out there.
And they're doing that with real estate.
Yes, we have a lawyer that does that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Linda, do you think it's worth our effort to do that then?
Sure, and we need to look at several and get the best rate. Our real estate attorney, Steve, can you pull that one up? Because when I did that, it didn't come back up. Okay. This is your real estate one. And real estate, actually, we're doing good on, because I want to tell you that our tax attorney, we do have some properties that are up for sale, and I did not put this in your packet because it does have names, and I really don't want to.
But yet they're in the paper, aren't
they? Well, these are some that are pending right now, too. We have about 11 that... The notices have gone out too, but I don't think they're filed in the clerk's office yet, and they have not been in the paper. So, and one of those is a very large track. But in talking to Anthony Payone, who is the attorney, that's going to be settled. So we will get our money on that. I think that's pretty close to like $14,000-$15,000. So that one I don't think will go for sale. But since 2010 and using this attorney, and this is only done through October, he has collected, which at no cost to the county, about $756,000.
What
does he get?
His is set by code, and we don't pay him anything.
It's a fee
that he charges, according to the taxpayer. This is our money. He gets his money through the taxpayer, so that's an additional that it doesn't cost us anything. The only thing it costs us is airtime to give him the delinquent notices when we, you know, do an Excel. And would you like me to ask him?
What about these poor people who came on delinquent land for years and years, and there is no way to clear off that land? My husband left me with delinquent personal.
Mrs. Booker, we did have one of those.
I invested too much. I mean, but I know there are other people in the same situation I'm in.
Yes.
With delinquent land. Can't get rid of it.
You talking about your business?
No, not my house.
She's always talking about
the right. Not her town.
You know where it is.
It's over
by
the landfill.
No.
And we did have one of those.
You have a lot of properties that end up as legatee, you know.
Nobody wants it.
In the estate of. And if that happens about the second generation, you end up with 15 or 20 or 25. And they can't get consensus. And usually some member of the family takes it upon themselves to continue to pay the taxes, although they're not in position to sell it because they're only a 1/15th interest in the land.
And or you have people that don't even know they own the land.
That's yes, sir. That's a possibility. So
they are air way, way down the line.
Those are the ones you see go to, they stop paying taxes. Decades ago, if you paid the taxes for a period of time on a property that, you know, then you could take ownership of it as a result of having paid taxes. But that was eliminated, you know, about 20 years ago. In Virginia?
Yeah, you paid 15 years.
Years.
And so now what happens generally, if they can never get a family consensus, a lot of times they didn't, they just don't agree. They're just so separated, they can't figure out who all the heirs of the uncles and the great uncles and the aunts. So consequently, somebody will stop paying taxes, and that's when Linda will have to.
And we have three of those pending right now that are going to
be sold.
Yes. Okay.
And keep in mind, each one of those all have interest added to them.
Yeah, penalties and interest.
Like
so
personal property, penalty and interest, a lot of times will exceed the actual bill. The tax won't be as high as the penalty and interest.
And I would like to mention again that we do work with these people. We do have payment agreements. We have approximately 50 of them between personal property and real estate. These people pay a payment every month. And if they miss two payments, we no longer work with them. I mean, we give them a two-month, you know, we send them a notice that says, hey, you didn't make your payment. But we do work with those people. And on the real estate, we're not putting those up for judicial sale as long as they're making those payments. And a lot of these people, surprisingly, have caught up. We already have two of our faithful customers, two of our older citizens, that are already paying on their 2013 taxes. You know, so it's not like we play hardball, but if you work with us and you come forward, you know, and they come in the office, we know them by name now. We know them by first name because they're there every month or every 2 weeks. We have some that pay every 2 weeks.
Linda, say a person owes $600 in 6 months. Are you going to say, well, you can pay $100 a month and pay that in the following 6 months? How does that work? Is it $100 or is it $100 plus interest?
If they're delinquent, Mr. Weaver, that penalty goes on regardless, you know.
Even though they're paying us.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's the Virginia code.
And I,
but if they have a $600 bill and they've paid $400 on it, that reduces the penalty down. But a lot of these people on their own have calculated, of course, you know, they'll say, well, how much are our taxes going to be this year? We don't really know. But we say, oh, add about, you know, $20 more or whatever. So they pretty much have calculated what it's going to cost them in 6 months. If it's over, we just take it and apply it to the second half, you know, and they keep on going. So, like, some of them have already overpaid 2012, so they have a credit for 2013. I mean, and a lot of people, believe it or not, they're not just delinquent. They want to make a payment every month so that they can get ahead of their bill when they get it. So our system allows us to do what's called a prepayment. We just put their parcel number in there or their social in there, and it applies to them. And then when we get ready to run our bills, we take those prepayments and move them over, and it takes it right off that bill before they get it. So when we mail a bill, it has the credit out there on it.
And there's no, some industries, if there's prepayments, the money you have to, it's like you owe them something because you had their money in advance. If their state's done it for property taxes,
we don't give them a 10% or a 20% or whatever discount for paying early. We don't have that. I mean, that's not in our county ordinance. So that's basically what we have. And the public service, we usually just, that's pretty much 100%. We do have one that's outstanding out there right now, and I think that's one of the weird telephone ones. So we usually just have to send them a reminder.
Now, the business personal property tax.
That goes in with your regular personal property.
Right. From what I understand, if you don't voluntarily let the county know you're in business, they don't pay personal property tax because you don't technically know they exist because we don't have a business license.
That's correct.
There are actually businesses here in the county that aren't paying personal property tax because...
No, they may not be paying business personal property, but they're paying on their vehicles.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Sure. I'm talking about if you open candy stores.
Yeah, okay.
Let's say you have a lawn service, if you'll permit me.
And you have a
truck and a trailer that you haul around three lawnmowers on, and they're $5,000 lawnmowers or whatever.
Sure.
You pay on the truck and the trailer because they're tagged and it comes through DMV. But if my office doesn't know that you have a lawn care service, and I'm required to try to do methods of discovery. I'd look at the paper. I'd look at the Flu Banner, you know, review web page because it's got advertisements for businesses. And then ride around. When I'm out there looking for property, if I see a sign that's gone up and says, you know, M&D Widgets, you know, I'm all the time in the industrial park up at Zion's Crossroad calling up the office and go, do we have the one that's associated with, you know, in the reading of the name? So if I don't know they are operating in the county, and I, the only way I have now is basically through their advertisement or observation, word of mouth, then we miss them. But they'd be small. The business personal property, like the lawnmowers,
I know, it's only a couple hundred bucks.
Well, it could be more. You know, if they are, they run a backhoe service, and it's a $50,000 backhoe, again, we get the truck and the trailer, but not the piece of equipment. They have to report that to us, and then we tax them. And we tax them on that piece of equipment. And what our code says is anything that they purchased at $100 or more, we tax them on for the first 10 years that they own it. So even if it's used, say I bought a 1995 backhoe, I'm going to get taxed on it for the first 10 years I own it. And so I have to know they're out there. And what the code allows me, if I miss somebody and find out about it later, I'm allowed to go back and tax them back for up to 3 years of back taxes. Conversely, I can refund them with Linda's concurrence and Fred's agreement if I overtax them for something they got rid of and failed to tell me, and it happens a lot, believe it or not. I can refund them for up to 3 years. If they paid for it for 5 years before they finally came in and said, oh, I didn't own that bulldozer, I got rid of that thing, I can only reimburse them for the previous 3 years. I don't care.
On the other end of it is if they go out of business and they don't come and sell you,
they'll get a bill, and they usually won't come tell us until they get that bill.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
That's correct.
So that's why discovery is so important. And we try hard to be on top of it, but small kind of slide in business and go out of business.
Business license, whether it costs $20 or $10 or free, because then you can count the businesses that are actually in your county.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. Is there any public list of
businesses that the neighbors are not missing?
Oh, Joe's not. Well,
we have a list of about 650 businesses that we do tax for business personal property as well as machinery and tools.
Right.
And machinery and tools is that piece of it that if they make something, like the machine company up on Slaughter's Ford, you know, that makes stuff, if you get the machinery and tools tax rate, that's a lower rate.
Sure.
The board, you know, 210 versus 415.
You see, this leads to more things. This is a sign that we're missing things there, because there's a large percentage of signs out there that have never been registered.
I would submit we have, I think by and large, got most all of them.
Yeah.
Now, there's certainly going to be some startups, small ones particularly, that we might miss. You know,
I know a couple of years ago there was a push for that.
Yes, sir. We didn't miss Better Living, you know, and Food Line, you know, but we might miss.
No, we don't have
small
one.
But we, again, I can reach back for 3 years and tax them if
we don't have
one. I have a question.
Sure.
Linda, what kind of interest are we making when we put our money in? And do we have CDs?
Well, I've got some right here. Strange you ask.
Okay.
Yeah, really. At BB&T across the street, we have $1,052,456. That's at a 0.07%. With Wells Fargo, we have $2 million, which will mature on February the 5th, 2013. That's at 0.25%.
That's
yes.
That's a quarter of one.
Then we have LGIP, which is your local government investment pool. We have $1,573 in that, and that's paying a 0.194%.
So it's nobody, nothing.
Well, there's only one thing that I can.
Nobody, I hate to say this, nobody wants local government money because it has to be backed.
It's even personal.
Yeah. It has to be, the collateral has to be out there. Like if BB&T, they have $1 million, they have to have $1 million set aside as collateral for us. It used to be 50, but it's 100 now. So, and I did call BB&T again today because I wanted to move this 1052. For 30 months, it's 0.20.
So if you put it there, it's going to stay...
For 20 months. It's not even 1%.
But what was it you and I talked about, then? That you might have provided about 10 banks that qualified for that money?
Mm-hmm.
Some of those, we were going to get more.
More.
And
but
what happened?
They're not interested in us.
Why?
Because it's... putting out their money. It ties their money up also. And the only one that I'm still working with is Union Bank, so we can spread it all out locally, which, you know, then we get the bank franchise tax. So.
Well, we ate out of the bonds.
Yes.
And, you know, and this isn't going to change until inflation hits.
Yeah. But Mrs. Booker, that's the best we can do. There's just, you know, LGIP is your local, you know, that's...
What about money market?
The BB&T is money market. That's 0.07%.
There's money...
And it's less than that right now.
Bonds now that you can get guaranteed 3%, and it's a steady thing. But I don't think it qualifies the taxpayers' money. But
yeah, see, that's their problem. And I'm going to tell you, gentlemen and Mrs. Booker, I'm a very conservative person. I am not going to put local government money, the taxpayers' money, anywhere that it's not protected.
Right. That's protected.
And
right.
Yes.
Anything with a higher rate now, so you're locking up
your
money and
yeah.
Just
the
way it is, right?
Yeah. That's all I have. Is that 3 minutes? Okay.
Your slide says, where did you find one?
Mm-hmm. Mine came right off of my general ledger.
Okay, and then
Mel had a different. I saw that too.
So we're $290,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's going to be different because when he first base his
right,
it's going to be on last
year's, yes, and then
he has to go back and
make the supplements and yes,
do it with this year's total.
Okay,
that's
so
going to be
the actuals are
yes, yes, those are our actuals, okay?
Okay?
You have my word on that,
okay.
Yeah.
Sure, Linda.
If I'm wrong, my collections are wrong.
Before you leave.
Okay. Okay.
So we're going to look at potential collection support for personal property.
Yes.
On top of it. That's a request for our business.
Now, will you give me till February to come back to you guys?
Sure.
Okay. February, March, somewhere in there.
But you can come back anytime.
Okay. Okay. Or I'll just get it to Steve.
The task for request is to look at collection options for
personal property. Yes.
Okay. Anything else?
A lot of guys will sell vehicles for taxes for waste. Can we do that kind of
stuff? No, we do not. And we get lots of complaints for it.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Our already taxes on vehicles and stuff.
We talked about that.
Mr. Sherman gave you a report last
year. And there's pros and cons, and you really don't come out.
He gave you a report last spring, and we've got to run
over
the mess. But it's there's pros and cons on both sides. But
it's such a small dollar amount that it's not even worth talking about.
No, it's not even worth talking about. Well, for instance, for me, when I bought a car this year, I'm not paying any taxes on it.
Well, good.
So I'm not paying any taxes on an older car.
You're the taxpayer, though. I'm glad you get ahead.
Well, you do it, then I'll bet. But
yeah,
but you do it on the other end. Sold it on the first day of the year, second day of the year, I still pay taxes on it.
But the taxpayer, as much money as you can.
piece of tax cash.
So how about the finance and stuff, banking and interest?
Yeah, I would like to.
What?
We're looking to bank and see if we can find someplace to pay a little bit more.
Okay, so two requests.
Right.
One on the investment plans and what we're getting or whatever possible, and then possible collections options for personal property.
You know, that's another one of those things that right now you're stuck. That's the way the market is. And you can only have so much money in each bank because you're only protected at FCIC, DIC, for a certain amount of money.
Depends on how aggressive you want to be.
Well, they have, what do they call that? Cedars, where they move their money to all different banks all over the country. That way you don't have
to. But anyway, those are the two request taskers I'll send.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Motion to look at those.
So you have a motion to adjourn. Is there a second?
Thank you.
Motion made by Mr. Albrecht, seconded by Mr. Weaver, all in favor.
Why don't you?